We are now recording.
Thank you, Kurt. I'm going to call to order the Board of Technical Registration for Tuesday, September 28th. Kurt, can you do a roll call for our board members?
Dr. Alejandro Angel. Jack Gilmore.
Here.
Neil Jones.
Here.
Clarence McAllister.
Here.
Carmen Wyckoff.
Here.
Stephen Knoll.
Here.
Andrew Everode.
Here.
Helen Pack. Stacy Skanky. We have a quorum.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. I think due to the amount of call-ins and folks, we'll just go in straight order. So our, let's start with adoption of minutes. Do I hear a motion to adopt the minutes of August 24th, 2021?
I move, Chair, that we adopt the minutes of August 24th, 2021.
Thank you. Do I hear a second?
I'll second that, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Gilmore. All those in, can we do a verbal on this one? I think we can. All those in favor of the adoption of the minutes, say aye.
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 We do not have a quorum, so...
No, it's okay for the minutes. It's okay.
It's okay for minutes. Okay.
For you to vote.
Aye.
You're allowed to vote. Thank you for approving. Any of the opposed say nay? Minutes pass. Okay, next up is the call of the public. This is if you're not on the agenda but want to speak to the board. Do we have any members in our call of the public? Hearing none, our first case is FA1. Joey Alessio, are you here or on the phone?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent, thank you.
He's just here for questions.
Yeah, Mr. Alessio, and I apologize if I've butchered your last name, but your case is up for dismissal at the moment or closure. Is there anything you wish to say to the board before we vote on your case?
No.
Okay, thank you for calling in for questions. Board members, any questions or discussion on this, or do I hear a motion?
Well, I'll make a motion that we accept the H122002 for dismissal or closure.
Thank you, Mr. Gilmore. Thank you, Mr. Jones. Hearing no discussion, do we need a roll call on this one or a verbal?
I think you can do a verbal.
Okay. Just so all those in favor of dismissal, say aye.
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 Any opposed, say nay. Excellent. 5A1 is dismissed.
Madam Chair, and I just joined. This is Alejandro Angel.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Angel. And I believe Ms. Can you pronounce your last name for me?
Skanky.
Thanks. Thanks, Ms. Skanky. Welcome aboard.
Sorry.
No worries. It's always a little tough to find.
First time.
And getting through downstairs is sometimes a bear, too. So, welcome. Okay, so for the record, we now have both Dr. Angel and Ms. Skanky at our board meeting, so we have eight. Yes, Dr. Angel just picked up. So thank goodness we are in good shape for a quorum for the rest of the day, right?
We should be here till 4.
Right. Okay, we are going to be out of here before the building closes. Okay, so 5A2 and 3 for board members. This are two related cases. They both stem out of the same ledger and have a similar respondent. And I believe, is the ledger in the, Mr. Grief, are you in the room or on the line? Okay, please, if you want to come forward to the table and make sure you use your, as we say, outdoor voices, because some folks are on the line. Now, for board members, this is a civil case and Mr. Grief, if you could, just in about 3 minutes, just like we do, call to the public, sort of explain why you brought this case before us, and then we'll hear from the investigator for a few minutes.
My name's Kevin Grief.
And I did submit some paperwork that should be in your packet.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to go through that really quickly and clarify any questions you might have about that. The first page is fairly clear. It outlines the city standards, and the second page, during the course of the process, I filed the complaint, I think, January, and it took quite a while to get anywhere. But it also, it became evident that there was a much bigger problem that I hadn't identified initially, which was that the drainage basin that was delineated for the Hope Street project basically was sort of created in a vacuum and did not include drainages that feed to that specific piece of ground. So if you look at the third page, it shows the drainage basin as delineated in the drainage report. Area 3 is roughly it's listed as 1.31 acres in the original drainage report. But if you look at the contours and the contour map on the following page, there's a significant area of land to the northeast that actually drains into Area 3 that was not included. That land, there's about 5 acres there that actually runs right to the highway. The highway is super elevated, so everything that hits the highway runs across the highway and ends up going into that Area 3. The following page shows an ADOT drainage report that actually overlaps the Hope Street project. And if you look at that, I've identified Hope Street on there. That drainage report includes 13.3 acres. All of it to the northeast, or sorry, it would be the northwest of the highway. So not all of that water runs into Hope Street, but quite a bit of it does. There's a dashed line, which is the thawing of the drainage, and that is actually sort of the road that comes out of a trailer park. I'll show you some photographs in there later on. That water crosses the highway and ends up running down Hope as well. The next sheet, which would be sheet 6, shows another overlapping drainage report that came from a Canyon Run development. It also shows a considerable amount of.
You're on the line and you're in traffic. Are you listening to yourself? Thank you.
It also shows a considerable amount of area to the north of the highway, and some of that overlap also runs into the Hope Street project. If you look at the following page 7, that's a photograph of water running down from the trailer park that's shown in the sheet previously. It runs across the highway, and then there's a little white car there, and it's running across the highway and into the Hope project.
Can
we get a reference? You reference sheet 7.
Can you please show us?
Oh, there aren't page numbers on here?
Well, our board packet is over 3,000 pages, so I believe our board is having a little trouble following along.
Okay, I'll hold them up as I can.
And, Madam Chair, I think page 77 of our packet is the first page of the complaint, 77 or 78. Let me.
It is. I was looking at the photographs on 283 as well, so.
Okay. There's photographs. If you start there, that's page 1 of the complaint, so you just add what he has, I think.
Okay.
There's photographs in 78, 79, 81, 82, 83, 85.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Angel.
Mm-hmm.
It would be best if you can follow the packet I sent to the report. That's what I thought.
Okay, so page 81 of our packet is page 5 of 11. and has photographs that you sent us?
The photographs would be shortly thereafter. This is the photograph of the trailer park driveway with water flowing. And this is after a minor storm just a few weeks ago. It crosses the highway and heads down Hope Street. This is the primary access to the mobile home park. On the next page, there is another photograph. Let's make sure I get them straight here. Okay, the next page is looking the other direction, looking up Hope Street toward the mobile home park. And again, it's showing water flowing out of that outlet across the highway and down into the Hope Street. It would be the area 3 in the drainage report.
Okay.
All right.
Board members, that's on page 239 of your packet, that particular photo.
Now, during the EAC hearing, I asked, I had submitted email to the Board of Technical Registrations related to this problem. I did ask if it had been addressed by the EIC. Mr. Jeffers was the only member that spoke. He said that his comments did not include any analysis of this issue. So the EIC, as far as I know, did not look at this at all carefully. I did send them a copy of the ADOT report when I sent the email. So they should have had plenty of information to kind of get the at least mm-hmm. that the fact that there was a problem here. All right.
And Mr. Greif, or Greif, just as a background, our statute has a very narrow purview of what we can look at. And that's whether somebody has done their job to the level of professional expectations of others in the state. So I appreciate all the information you've given us. But we don't settle, I guess we don't settle whether the outcome was satisfactory. We look really narrowly at the professional conduct. So if you could describe in a more succinct way what professional conduct you think was not appropriate.
The purpose of a drainage report is to figure out where water's gonna run and who it's gonna affect. Mm-hmm. And basically what was done in this case is the Hope Street project isolated only a piece of the actual drainage basin and then developed all of the formulas and calculations based on essentially 55% of the basin. So it doesn't really reflect the amount of water that's draining into that particular area. There is a statement in the drainage report that they reviewed the topography and walked the area, but as the photographs show and the other drainage reports show, very clearly, they didn't really want to look at any more than they have to. Mm-hmm. And the result is that the actual drainage report that was written for the Hope Street project doesn't in any way reflect the actual condition there. And the facilities that they put in, both in terms of drainage ditches, riprap, containment within the roadways, is all based on numbers that just aren't accurate.
Thank you, I appreciate that. The investigators here, can we hear from you?
The respondents here.
On the phone? Let's go.
One is here.
Oh, I apologize. Please, can you come forward and let's pull up another chair and state your name? I appreciate that. I did not see you there.
Good morning to the honorable board members and whoever is on the board, Dr. Angel, I believe, mm-hmm. if I got his name right. My name is Sirisha Kaluri. I'm with Woodson Engineering. I'm one of the registrants here in the complaint. So I could speak a little bit. I don't want to take too much of time.
Yep, about 3 minutes would be awesome.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, firstly, thank you very much to the board and the EAC committee for going through this case. It has been a long process for everyone. And through the process, we have provided written responses from my side, three letters, which went in detail explaining the allegations and what we did calculations-wise. It did get into the technical details and everything. So if there are any questions, I can certainly answer, just because, and as I said, there were lengthy responses already in response to the allegations that were raised by Mr. Bragg.
Absolutely. So considering what we just talked about, can you just give the board, other than Dr. Angel, unfortunately we are not civil engineers, can you give us maybe the high-level view of why perhaps only part of the basin was considered in this drainage report, or if there was a little more background on that?
So one of the letters that I had provided in response to the email, or the complaint that was in the email, which actually came after the original complaint during the process, we did respond to that, and so we referenced ADOT, a state highway drainage report, which did analysis for the highway, and it clearly delineated the drainage areas. And apparently, for the size of this project, you know, it's very usual for engineers to reference previously approved projects. And in this case, it's a state highway project done by another engineering firm, pretty reputable firm. So yeah, it's a pretty common practice to reference other approved drainage studies, and that's what we used. I did take a look at the drainage area just to see if there is any remnant area that kind of drains into the highway. There's maybe like half acre or even less, and there were guardrails at the driveway entrances which would take some of the flows. There's a little bit of curb and gutter that takes some of the flows. I understand it's super elevated and slopes south. But one thing we have to understand is, you know, when the street is sloping south, it doesn't mean all flow comes to the south. There is something called as a split flow analysis. Apparently, those are all the nitty-gritty calculations. So for this project, as I said, we used the previously referenced studies. One of the things I really want to bring up is, and I also provided this in the response, we use something called as time of concentration, like 5 minutes, which is pretty conservative, and that's the city of Prescott standard. Even ADOT, the state highway, uses time of concentration like 10 minutes. So this project has a pretty big safety factor, and we should remember that. And apparently, you know, it's city standard. We just try to use that. So that gives a lot higher flow than other studies, you know, for same area, same parameters, but time of concentration is a pretty significant role in hydrology. So this project has a lot of safety factor.
Thank you. I think Mr. Schuller might be on the phone. If you are, as a respondent, can you unmute yourself?
Yes, this is Richard Schuller on the phone from Woodson Engineering.
Welcome, Mr. Schuller.
And thank you. I don't really have anything to add other than Sarisha there addressing that last part that did come after all the original complaint, and she did give a detailed response to that as well, talking about which parts were not tributary in that, and I feel that that has been answered through the document.
Thank you, Mr. Schuller. Mr. Rome, do you want to have your 3 minutes of fame?
If it'll take that long. This case proceeded similarly to all others in the sense that it went for assessment by enforcement advisory committee members, after which an enforcement advisory committee meeting was held. It took considerable time and effort to go through all the documents. In fact, one of the attachments I sent to the EAC members was 566 pages. The EAC meeting itself was nearly 4 hours. And I'm both comfortable and confident with regard to what our EAC members did in considering the case and hearing it and interviewing witnesses and making their decision. Ultimately, the conclusion was they've identified both cases appropriate for dismissal, And I support that, and that's why it's before you now. It's for it to be, both cases to be dismissed. And nothing that I've heard since then has changed that.
Thank you. So now I'd like to open it up to board member questions or discussion. Yes.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
A question to the engineers. Did you, when you looked into the upgradient drainages done by others, Dibble, whoever, ADOT approved, does that drainage or those volumes, were they then like an input into your particular study area? Or are they diverted around, or was that water taken into account? Or what is there water to be taken into account?
So yes, we did look into those drainage reports. So what this study takes into account is what directly comes into Hope Streets and impacts the facilities that were being designed. We also identified steady flows that were coming to the south, but directly did not come into this project. So the study did identify.
Chair, have a question. What was the size of the storm? Is this a 100-year, 200-year event?
So we looked at different storm events. We looked at 10-year, 25, 50, and 100. And depending upon the facility that's being designed for, we use the relevant storm event. Like for storm rains, we use 10-year storm event. Culverts, we use 25, and so on.
Well, I understand that for design, but it was the particular event where this flooding occurred. Did anybody analyze the size of that particular event?
You mean the previous historic events?
Well, there's flooding as a result of this particular storm event. Did someone size that particular storm? Was it a 100-year storm?
Oh, where the photos were taken?
Yeah.
Do we know that?
Oh, those photos were a 20-minute rainfall. Okay. That was nowhere near a flood event. That was taken 2-3 weeks ago after, maybe 20, 30 minutes of rain.
One thing then, because we are talking about the historic storm events here, looked at the NOAA records, and this year, this project revered, that is within the vicinity of the project, we looked at the gauges, and NOAA records show that this area has received one of the, this is like the wettest monsoons they had, and it's fourth wettest in the last 103 years. So the project area must have received a few 100-year storms in the, I don't know, and I can't put the time, but that subdivision has been there for quite some time, at least 30, 40 years.
Could I
Mr. Winter, I'm sorry, our staff wants to interject for a moment.
I just want to remind board members to please announce your name for the record before you speak, just for those on the phone as well as for our recording.
Thank you.
Can I comment? My name is Kevin Greif. I have a page from the original drainage report, and Area 3 is listed as being 1.31 acres with a 25-year runoff of 8.1 cubic feet per second and a 100-year runoff of 11.5 cubic feet per second. But the actual area that's draining there is more like 6.09 acres, which is about five times what's shown in the drainage report. And that what you saw in that photograph represents a minor rainfall, not a 25 or 100-year event. Some of the water is diverted along the farther to the east and goes into a drain at a road farther east at Pima Road. But the bulk of the road, most of the drainage coming across the highway, anything that's basically west of Joseph Street ends up going down Joseph Street. And in the ADOT report, it states that when they did that job, there were reports of water coming across the highway from the trailer park, flooding the hotel parking lot on the other side. So there's historic evidence of water in large volume flowing across the highway that is in no way represented in this report.
So how do you respond to that?
So looking at the, as I said, we looked at the Dibble reports, and it clearly talks about the tributary areas and where they're flowing, and it's included in our drainage report as well. Any culverts that were flowing south, the flow has been accounted for in this drainage study, and we talked about it. It directly does not impact the facilities that were being designed for. And one thing to just remind everyone is this is a mitigation project. So what has been done is just to mitigate local flooding that's happened happened on the Hope Street project itself. And city provided their input. We worked on within their standards, using their standards, and the flooding history has been provided to the city, and they've been there for quite some time. So all the input and the information is what we used in the previous appropriate studies. And we did actually include them and talk about the flows that were coming from the other side of the highway. And highway projects are done very diligently. They usually do not miss anything. And if they actually cannot design any of the facilities, so sometimes, we know the problems, but there wouldn't be enough budget to address all the problems. That has been clearly identified in those reference studies.
So what you're saying is what Kevin is referring to wasn't in your scope of work. You had a very small scope of work, mitigation. And what Kevin's talking about is that's another project.
It's not
hire another civil engineer, fix the problem.
And well, except that all that water ends up in the system they built. So the culverts aren't big enough, the drainage ditches aren't big enough, the riprap isn't big enough. So their report is saying these facilities that we're putting in will handle a 25-year event or a 100-year event. One of the drainage ditches, drainage ditch C, has basically freeboard of like 6 inches, which means that if they get much more water, it's going to go over the top of the ditch and flood out Lot 10. And so all the facilities that they've developed and the calculations that they've made are based on sort of a subset of the water that's going to show up. And that just doesn't make any sense.
I understand that, but it wasn't in their scope of work. I guess who's your client, the city or
the agency? The city of Prescott.
Yeah, so they issued you a scope of work.
Mm-hmm. And we were given an easement
supplement. But maybe you brought it up, what Kevin's talking about. Hey, you guys, this could be seriously impact our little scope of work. You want to expand it to include that?
So
he said, and they said, no, probably.
So from the... Again, from the drainage report, it says Hope Street, utilizing contour data provided by the city, supplemented with a topographic survey performed by Woodson Engineering and Surveying, the contributing drainage area was evaluated from a field wall.
Sorry, we have another point up here. Sorry for the interruption, Mr. Winter.
I was going to say Dr. Angel has raised his hand.
So, and yes, we would like to concentrate on board member questions at this moment. Dr. Angel, what's your question? And thank you, Kurt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Alejandro Angel. I wanted to ask both parties a couple of questions. And first, maybe for Mr. DeGrave, I saw the pictures you sent from Highway 89. And I'll admit, I spent a lot of time in this case, and I don't think I have a full handle on it, so I'm relying on the EAC assessment to a large degree. But my question specifically is, do you feel this project made drainage conditions worse for your property? And if so, how?
So all three outlets of the drainage system that they developed outlet on my property.
Are you lot 38?
No, I own the property along Granite Creek.
Which do you have a lot number? That's one thing I struggle with, is figuring out which one was your property specifically.
Let me see if I can find you a map that shows it.
If you have an address, I can also follow along that way.
So.
And Mr. Garth, maybe I'll explain what I'm, or why I'm asking is, I think when I look at the plans for the project, so, for instance, you might not have the plans in front of you, but for the board, in the packet on page 221, you can see the as-built plan for the area. And it looks like, in this area, there's always been a depression. There's a big dip in an area that feeds the Granite Creek behind the houses, behind Hope Street. It doesn't look to me like the project changed where the drainage was, you know, maybe a couple of feet here and there, but the low spots were always low spots. And then there were, and I'm not trying to say that they meet 100-year design or not, but also the what was out there before, and you noted this, Mr. DeGrasse, was that there were hand-dug ditches and that the new improvements convey more water. So I'm not sure. I know there's a lot of subtleties, but I'm not seeing how – what I'm trying to look at is this, does this damage you in terms of your property interest or you or your safety? And I see that the drainage structures have more capacity than before. The outlets have riprap to slow down the velocities, which should decrease erosion compared to pre-construction conditions. So I'm trying to understand where the damage is, specifically.
I think I can answer that for you, Kevin. The capacity of the hand-dug ditches was pretty minimal, and the majority of the runoff that got to my property was sheet flow. And what's happened now is those drainages have been, the volume's been increased, the velocity's been increased, and it's also been concentrated. The two of the ditches, A and B, actually, the outlets, let me start with A. A is a concrete culvert. That outlet goes into riprap, but the outlet is actually below grade. So when there's a high flow, that basically is just going to start eroding the stream bank there and ripping it apart. The ditch B is a kind of a V-shaped line ditch. It also basically runs into a wall of dirt. And it also was at one point a one-foot deep hand-dug ditch. Now it's carrying considerably more water, and it's going to just basically, again, tear another, big cleft in that stream bank. The ditch for C, the volume there was increased due to the diversion of more water between lots 7 and 8. That ditch, basically, they riprapped before it got to the end of the easement, and all of that water pours out of the side of the easement, again, onto my property, and it's finished. The easement isn't on my property. The drainage easement the city has for that ditch extends another 30 foot beyond where they basically let the thing just leak out of the side. So in all these three instances, I'm just going to see a bunch of erosion. I've had previous problems with the city in terms of structures they've built in that area, and they've refused to maintain anything. So I'm pretty concerned that they didn't get the easements they needed to do this, and the real reason that they didn't get the easements is they didn't want to agree to maintain anything. So basically they're concentrating water and diverting water, and I'm going to end up having to live with the consequences.
Dr. Angel, more questions?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I see two questions here. One is, did this make flooding worse on your property, Mr. Greif? And I don't see it. You're in depression. If anything, those structures having more capacity will convey more flow away from your, finished floor elevation. So that point I'm fairly comfortable with, that it's not an issue. The other question you bring up is the erosion at the outlets. And that one, I can see some merit there. This question is probably more for the engineers of the city of Prescott. There's discussion in the packet that there were easements obtained elsewhere through eminent domain, but the easements were not acquired here. So how are those channels and culverts built, and how are they maintained, if someone can clarify that? Whose responsibility is it to maintain that?
So the easements that are, this is Sirisha Kanduri.
Thank you.
I'm the engineer. So the locations where the improvements are shown, there were easements obtained by the city, and just by the mere responsibility, you know, the city does have responsibility to maintain the easements that's given in any drainage easements, and so where the facilities or the stormwater management facilities are proposed and constructed, there are easements obtained by the city.
Thank you.
Can I come up, this is Kevin, can I respond to that?
Sure.
Yes, sir, thank you.
Yeah, the easements were retained or obtained up to my property line. There are no easements for the discharge. And in the past, the city's response, they put bollards and cables across Granite Creek and ripped out a big chunk of my land, and basically they told me to fix it and they take care of it. And then when it came time to take care of it, they refused. So my experience has been, and the argument the city makes is they don't have the legal obligation to maintain things because they may not have the financial ability to do it. So when you go back to the city and say, we want you to fix this, it's really difficult without a lawsuit to get any traction. And I don't want to have to go through a lawsuit every time it rips that place apart. And it doesn't seem like I have any obligation to take on this responsibility. So it's really easy to say, the city takes care of stuff, but they don't. And that was the sticking point. I went to the city and said, I'll give you easements, but I want you to build a structure that you're willing to maintain, and I want the easement agreement to have some teeth in it. So if you don't maintain it, I can, and somehow get compensated for doing the work. And at that point, the whole thing fell apart. There's actually a statement in one of the addendums from the drainage report saying that the city couldn't get easements. Well, they have the power of eminent domain. They chose not to use it, and the reason they chose not to use it was because they don't want to take any responsibility for taking care of this stuff.
So, Mr. Greif, that does seem to be the fundamental issue, seems to be between you and the city, and not the engineer in question.
The engineer's just doing, she's just doing her job. Sounds like we need to talk to the city engineer.
Except that in the city general engineering standard, it says that if you're going to concentrate a drainage, you need to get the approval of the city engineer to do that. And that, to my knowledge, has not been done. Otherwise, the discharge onto the adjoining property has to remain the same. If that all remained sheet flow, I wouldn't have the problem with basically erosion that I'm going to end up with now.
Would you like to address that?
This is Sirisha, the engineer, Sirisha Kaluri. So yes, thanks for bringing up the point. We were given limited easements. Apparently, those were the areas that we could work. And we did put in recommendations in regards to, if it needs to be further spread out, they could use level spreaders or so, but they needed to get easements, and we constantly brought this up to the city and left it as recommendations in our report. So we did not ignore that or say that this is all good or this is the end of the project or anything, but anything more needed to be done needs easement and inform city. We provided the plans and drainage reports to the city, and it's after their approval the project gets constructed. So yes, city did see this, and they had laid their eyes on the project. So it went through the standard review approval process. So we didn't do something blindsiding the city. That's not possible in our public works projects.
So board members, I'm sorry, we've had a four-hour EAC and a very healthy discussion here for half an hour. I'd like to hear if other board members have questions about this. Yes?
Madam Chair, this is Steve Noel. I don't necessarily have a question, but it seems to me what's been discussed, it's not a professional engineering issue that the professional did something incorrect. It's more of an issue between the landowner and the city in terms of how they might maintain drainages. Mm-hmm. So I would like to make a motion that we dismiss both case 5A, 2 and 3 together.
Well,
thank you, Mr.
Just Kevin, I feel terrible for you. I just, but it's true. We don't. She didn't do anything wrong here. She's just doing her job, doing what the city told her to. This was between you and the city, and I feel terrible about that because I understand, you know, working with municipalities and the financial situations they're in, and they're not going to do anything. Happens on my buildings too. People don't maintain their buildings, but it's a tough spot. I feel.
Mr. Jones, is
can I just
second?
Read something? This is in the general engineering standard. Concentrated drainage flows for all swell frequencies shall enter and depart the property to be developed in substantially the same manner and location as under pre-development conditions, including consideration of depths, widths, and velocities. Substantial deviation from pre-development flow patterns will require written acceptance and drainage easements from the affected adjacent property owners and approval by the city engineer. This is in the Prescott GES standards. When the plan was submitted to the city and for the board to approve, the city council to approve, the project was supposed to meet these standards, and I don't think they've gotten the easements they need to comply with the standards. And that's an engineering obligation.
That's a you and the city issue. Mr. Winter, would you like to?
Dr. Angel would like to speak.
Dr. Angel, thanks for raising your hand.
Madam Chair, I'm going to second the motion, but would like to have just a brief discussion with the
okay.
board.
If so we have a motion from Dr. Knoll and a second from Dr. Angel to dismiss, and now we are in board member discussion.
So if I may start a discussion, I agree with a lot of what was said. I don't think my understanding now is Mr. Goliath is in the property that's behind the houses, more on Granite Creek itself, which is a FEMA floodplain. It's a lot of it is undevelopable, most of the property. It's certainly where the water is discharging. So I don't see the engineers at fault here, but I also don't sort of subscribe to what Mr. John was saying, that, hey, you just do what the city tells you. You do what the city tells you until you're impacting someone and creating an issue. So, in this case, I think, yes, it's a maintenance issue. It's not up to the engineer. And it's about the city of Prescott abiding or not abiding by its own requirements, which could be an issue, but it's not an issue for the board. I think we're looking at the conduct of the engineers. And I really, other than some minor inaccuracies, I see as de minimis. In reality, they're not causing additional flooding to anybody or problems for health, safety, and welfare. So that's why I think we could dismiss.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Alejandro,
board member discussion?
Alejandro, she did mention that she brought this up with the city time and time again.
Yep.
So.
Okay. Any other board members? Yes.
Mr. Hack,
would you like to weigh in, please? And I think you're still muted. Mr. Hack, I believe you're muted.
If you're on your phone, star 6. If you're on your computer, hit the unmute button.
Sorry, Mr. Hack, we're not hearing you quite yet. Any other discussion in the meantime? Or we have a first and a second to dismiss in front of us. Mr. Hack, are you seeing anything in chat?
I don't see anything in the chat. You're still muted. Mr. Hack, if you're on your phone, you hit star 6 to unmute yourself. If you're in the Google Meet, there's just the little icon with the microphone on the bottom that you would hit to unmute yourself. It's just names him, so I believe he's in the Google Meet on the computer.
Speaking out of turns for future board agenda items, I think we need to be in person more. I think it would go better. Okay.
Yeah.
That is out of turn, so before our Attorney General yells at me, I think we have a vote in front of us.
Roll call vote, please.
a roll call vote, please, Kurt?
Dr. Alejandro Angel.
This is to dismiss, just as a reminder.
And also to dismiss A2,
A2 and
A3.
Thank you. Since those are together.
Right.
I apologize, Kurt. Go ahead.
Dr. Alejandro Angel.
Aye.
Jack Gilmore.
Aye.
Neil Jones.
Aye.
Clarence McAllister.
Aye.
Carmen Wyckoff.
Aye.
Stephen Noel.
Aye.
Andrew Everode.
Aye.
Helmut Hack. And Stacey Skenke.
Aye.
Motion carried.
Thank you all for coming in. We appreciate your time, and I hope there's a better resolution for you, Mr. Gray. Okay. Excellent. So, 5B1.
B1,
boy is in boy one. We have the alleger and the respondent on our list are either in the room. This is Mr. Morrow and Mr. Cook. Are they?
Yeah,
I'm here. Mr. Cook, can you please come up front? And I believe, Mr. Morrow, are you on the line? And if you are, please unmute yourself and say hi. Not hearing the alleger quite yet, so I will give him a little more time while Mr. Cook, thank you for coming in. Your case is up for a resolution by a letter of concern. Do you have any questions about what a letter of concern is? Or any questions,
questions
in general? Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm here.
Do you know what a letter of concern is?
Obviously, I think it's just a concern that I didn't perform my job adequately enough.
There were minor violations, and so when there's a major violation, then there's a penalty and a little more that goes along with it. These were above a typo, but a minor violation is kind of
So you guys already reviewed it? Okay.
Yep, already reviewed. So right in front of us on board members on our agenda is 5B1, and that is proposed by resolution by a letter of concern.
Which is a non-disciplinary action.
Mr. Morrow, in two or three minutes, would you like to state why you brought this before the board? Mr. Morrow, we're not hearing you if you're speaking. I think we have a pretty good connection.
Him.
The crackling is you. So, Mr. Morrow, sorry, we're not hearing voices. In the meantime, Mr. Kramer, how about you take a couple minutes, give us an overview, and we can go forward.
Sure, Mr. Mr. Morrow, part of the thing was the board feeling that Mr. Cook did not do an etiquette he was expecting his property. This was a Mr. Cook is a Mr. Morrow is he's a landlord, and he was renting this after the inspection. He rented the property out, and approximately 2 months after the inspection, the tenants complained to him that the AC was not working and that the hot water heater was leaking. So that was the basis for the complaint. There was a EAC held. Actually, there wasn't. There was two assessments.
Mm-hmm.
And both assessors felt that the inspection done by Mr. Cook was adequate. A few minor detail deficiencies was noted by one of the assessors. But otherwise, neither one felt that an EAC was needed, was necessary. And therefore, based on that and the few minor deficiencies, staff that a letter of concern would be appropriate action at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. Mr. Morrow, are you able to weigh in? No? Okay. Board members, any questions about this case? If we don't have
Madam Chair?
Yes?
I just wanted to note that our packet includes photos showing, you know, the delta in temperature from the registers and the temperature from the water heater. And so, yeah, it's unfortunate, but I think whatever happened was after the inspection, and the inspector did his job. So,
is that a motion, Dr. Angel?
Sounds like it, doesn't it?
It does.
Yes.
Second.
Okay, I have a motion from Dr. Angel and a second from Mr. Jones about 5B1 to issue a letter of concern. Any questions? Kurt, a roll call vote. Oh, we have one question.
Brief question. This is Steve Noel. For the letter of concern, it seems to me that the inspection was done properly. You had issues that came after the fact. So the letter of concern is more of a, sounds like a general review of your report. It almost, it's like a second opinion of a report that you did that I guess it's good to have, but it doesn't necessarily show any negativity on this particular case and how you presented your report initially. It's just, I guess it's nice to have, some more information in future reports, but
could I speak? This is Mike Morrow. I'm calling in on my phone now.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Cook, can I answer a question at the moment?
Yeah, so I think what came down to this all happening is just kind of a lack of communication, I think, you know, partly online, and also just some retrospect about this. You know, I was a newer home inspector at this time, about 3 months in, you know, still trying to get my bearings on how to communicate with clients about what is more necessary to, you know, monitor, you know, what I feel I put adequately in my report, that I have conditions, noting concerns, you know, it just fell on the communication part of maybe me probably pushing him forward to have it further evaluated, you know. Ultimately, it shows on the report that the systems were functioning while I was there. I talked with him, Mr. Morrow, after the fact, you know, 2 months later when he was disappointed with everything. And I tried to explain to him that I can only report on things at the time of inspection, you know. I don't have a crystal ball to let him know what happens in the future, but I did point out deficiencies with the units, you know, that did recommend further evaluation on the report. It was just a lack of following through on Mr. Morrow's part, you know, the report. But obviously on the report, you know, like I said, 4 months into inspecting full time, I did look over the report and did find things, you know, that I was like, I should have put in there, you know, and obviously felt deficient on some of the things that should have been in the report. But as of this matter, I feel like you guys as well.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Mr. Morrow, now that you've called in about 2 minutes or so, can you explain why you brought this before the board, noting that we can only review Mr. Cook's obligation to follow state statutes and regulations, not perhaps the outcome, unfortunately, at your house.
Okay, well, this wasn't particularly where the problem with Mr. Cook. He probably did his job just fine. Mine was more of a general problem. We hired someone to do this kind of work in a house that we've never seen before. We're buying it remotely, and every major system in there failed within the first month, not 2 months. And what can I say? I mean, you pay money for something like that. If the company can't do the job, they ought to refund your money. I think Mr. Cook probably did his job as they told him to do it.
I appreciate it, and I feel for you. That's not a fun situation to be in. Unfortunately, our board can only weigh in on whether Mr. Cook upheld his professional standards. So with that, board members, we have a first and a second to issue a letter of concern. There's no further questions from us. Kurt, can we do a roll call vote?
Dr. Alejandro Angel?
Aye.
Jack Gilmore?
Aye.
Neil Jones?
Aye.
Dennis McAllister?
Aye.
Carmen Wyckoff.
Aye.
Stephen Noel.
Aye.
Andrew Everode.
Aye.
Helen Hack.
Aye.
Stacey Skanky.
Aye.
Motion carried.
Okay. Thank you for coming in. Thank you for calling, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
So 5B2 in our board packet. I believe the ledger might be on the phone. I apologize. Mr. Jones is coming
up with me. Someone muted you. Press star 6 to unmute. You unmuted yourself.
Oh. All kinds of noise.
No kidding. That was exciting. Okay, so 5B2. I believe the respondent, Ms. Sisson, is here. Mr. Sisson, sorry.
Yes.
I apologize. And our ledger, Joni Heflin, if you're on the phone, Hofflin, if you can speak up and say hi. Not hearing any, so Mr. Sisson, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Your case is a letter of concern, just like the previous gentleman. This is not a disciplinary action. It's kind of a gentle reminder, I guess, on minor items. Is there anything you'd wish to say to the board?
Yes, a couple things, if I may. And my first time here, so I appreciate the work that all of you do. And having that case before me gives me an idea of exactly what this is. I did want to state that in the allegation too by Mr. Leeds that we're talking about in reference to the letter, I just want to make clear that the board knows that in reference to item 1, 2, 3, and 5, I have changed those consistently in my reports. I have a couple thoughts about those, mm-hmm. but obviously we're trying to stay to the standards and meet those goals. And then in reference to number 4, I didn't quite understand that. I don't know that I can get any kind of an answer to that from a committee member, because as I look at the standards and I look at my report, I don't see anything there that made
This sense. Is about the gas notation.
Problem. Yes.
Yeah.
Other than that, like I said, I appreciate the work that all of you do, and I wanted to just comment that Mr. Rome was very good, had very good access to be able to communicate with and work through this process, and I appreciate that.
Appreciate you coming in. Mr. Rome, anything to add?
Well, actually, there really isn't much in this particular case. The two assessments done, one of the recommendations wasn't to take any action at all. The other was the identification of those 5 minor issues and issue a letter of concern, and I concurred with that, and that's why it's before you for that action today.
Thank you. Ms. Hofflin or Mr. Hofflin, sorry, Joni, I'm not sure, but are you on the line? Not hearing any board questions about this?
Yeah, no, not here.
Oh, excellent. Mr. Hofflin, in just a couple minutes, our board's purview is unfortunately not about whether or not your equipment worked later, but about whether Mr. Sisson fulfilled his professional duties as outlined by our rules. So if you'd like to address the board, now is your time. And I'm sorry if you're speaking, you might be muted. Or we're
Are you talking to me?
Is this Mr. Hack?
This is Hack, yes.
Okay, I apologize. Mr. Hack, you spoke up right as I was talking about the ledger. So my apologies, that's all me. Hey, Mr. Hack, you want to make a motion on this item since you're speaking to me?
Well, I can move to dismiss.
Well, how about move to with to issue a letter of concern? We have a minor letter of concern for this gentleman.
Okay. I move to accept the letter of concern.
Excellent. Do I have a second?
Second, that, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Gilmore. Any discussion? Kurt, a roll call.
Dr. Armando Angel.
Dr. Angel?
Sorry, aye.
Jack Gilmore?
Aye.
Neil Jones?
Aye.
Clarence McAllister?
Aye.
Carmen Wyckoff?
Aye.
Stephen Knoll?
Aye.
Andrew Everode?
Aye.
Helmut Pack?
Aye.
Stacey Skenke?
Aye.
Motion carried.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming in. I appreciate your time.
Thank you again, guys. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Okay, board members.
I make a motion, Chair.
I would love to hear a motion, Mr. Gilmore.
I'd like to have the board vote to accept the staff resolution by letters of concern for B3 and 4.
B3 and 4. We do not have a call-in or anybody signed in for those.
Second.
Second from Mr. Jones.
This pertains to B3 and 4, right?
Yep, 3 and 4. Letters of concern,
okay.
And we do not have any callers on those.
Okay.
Excellent. Kurt, a roll call.
Dr. Alejandro Angel?
Aye.
Jack Gilmore?
Aye.
Neil Jones?
Aye.
Clarence McAllister?
Aye.
Carmen Wyckoff?
Aye.
Stephen Noel?
Aye.
Andrew Everode?
Aye.
Helmut Pack?
Aye.
Stacey Skenke?
Aye.
Motion carried.
Excellent. So 5C1, I believe we have, this one we have a signed consent agreement. This was a case where a house in Sedona came before us. The EAC decided there weren't any deficiencies, but that they realized that Nancy Weinman, AIA, doing business as Weinman, did not have a firm registration. We commonly run into people who don't understand they need a firm registration as well. So I believe here we have all the standard, you didn't have your firm registered stuff, right? Sorry, speaking to the, I'm blanking on your name, I apologize.
Carthel.
Thank you, Mr. Carthel. All kind of the standard outcome and a signed consent agreement on this one?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Kurt, I see Ms. Weinman and the alleger is available if we have questions, correct?
Correct.
Ms. Weinman, are you on the phone?
If you have questions, I can go.
Board members, any questions in this case? We do have a signed letter, consigned consent agreement. Okay. Do I hear a motion on this, then?
I have a comment to make on this.
Please.
Where did I put my paper here? I was reviewing the statutes that were supposedly violated.
Mm-hmm.
Title 32-141, firm registration.
Yes.
I do not believe it applies to an individual. It applies to, and what they would say, I guess, legally, an artificial person. The Black's Law Dictionary describes a firm as a business entity or enterprise, unincorporated business, a partnership of two or more persons. So I don't believe 32-141 applies to her, and I would recommend that the case be dismissed.
Scott, you want to respond to that? Scott Donald?
Certainly. So, and there are a couple of different things we can do. I can discuss things, certainly in open session, if there are specific legal questions that people would like in executive session, we could certainly go into executive session, but just as an outset, Board Member Hack, so you would be discussing simply the case as regards the individual and not as regards the firm, correct?
Well, that's the charge is the firm, 141, which is saying that's what you, that's what the respondent violated. And if you, I've read 141, and I just don't see in there that it applies to a registrant, a single registrant that mm-hmm. has a license to practice and provides a service.
So,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Winter,
141 applies to a business that, you know, the principal or president is not a registrant. And that's what this is referring to. And I really don't believe it applies to the case.
Okay. Mr. Winter has his hand up.
Mr. Hack, I would like to refer you to 32-101-13, firm as the board defines firm. Firm means any individual or partnership, corporation, or other type of association, including the association of a non-registrant and a registrant who offers to the public professional services regulated by the board.
So our definition of a firm, in lieu of mm-hmm. a different legal definition, is an individual
or partnership.
Or partnership.
Well, we should be following the law.
Or partnership.
And this is just... you know, a rule made by an opinion. I think we should reconsider.
Mr. Heck, 32 is statute,
that
correct?
Is statute.
So unfortunately, that is the lawmakers.
Well, I'm going by the consent order. It does not list what, you know, I mean, if you're going to accuse someone of something, it all needs to be in the consent order.
Okay.
So what was just mentioned is not in the consent order. 141 is, and it does not apply.
But, Mr. Hack, the definitional statutes are going to apply to references that are in a consent order. For example, the consent order may not explicitly list every single statute under which the board operates, but if there's a definitional section, that would still define the terms that are used in those statutes.
Okay, well, let me bring up... you know, this kind of coincides with all the bills, Senate and House bills, that the board had seen over the last year.
Yeah.
And there's a document from the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Right to Earn a Living Act. The Goldwater Institute also talks about the same thing. And this is where the legislator is going, Kurt.
Mr. Hack, if I can... Yeah. Interrupt you, please. That's a very interesting discussion point, but the board is not agendized for any discussion of that. That's something okay. that certainly could be put on a future agenda, and if properly agendized, then that could be something for the board to discuss, but that's not actually agendized for the session today.
Yeah, well, okay, now the other problem I have with this consent order, now it was mentioned that the respondent had yet contacted the board to renew the to get a registration with the board. She has gone to the court commission, and I think the average person would think that's all they need to do. So it seems like no one has completely explained it to her that she needs to do, you know, pay the $25 fee to be good with the board. And the way that the consent order is set up, if nobody tells her that she needs to pay the $25 for the registration, she will be back with the possibility of having her license revoked, according to the consent order. So at least grant her, you know, a license for for the year for the firm if you're going to approve this.
So, Mr. Carthel, I'm asking the investigator, do you feel like Ms. Weinman now understands her obligations for her firm?
Yes.
Okay.
We had some email correspondence and a couple of phone calls where that was addressed. Her understanding beforehand was that being a sole proprietor, she did not need it. I did explain that it is still required, even if I believe it was the City of Sedona that accepted her as a sole proprietor. I did explain that we have different standards between the city, county, and state, and that it is something she needs to get taken care of, and she expressed willingness to do so.
Excellent. I appreciate your time making sure she understood that. So at this point, we have a motion and a second, correct, Kurt, on the table?
I don't think there's been a motion made yet.
Okay. I'm jumping ahead. Board members, is there a motion to accept this signed consent agreement?
So moved, Chair. I make a motion to accept 5C1 with the signed consent agreement.
Thank you, Mr. Gilmore. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Thank you, Mr. Knoll. Any further discussion by the board members?
Madam Chair,
this is
Alejandro Angel. I wanted to go back to a couple points that Mr. Hack brought up. I think, they're saying she practiced without firm registration as the representative of the firm. That's the statute she violated. And then you go back, you don't have to explain that you violated the definition of what a firm is. It's defined. And I think we can have a conversation as to whether firm registration requirements make sense or not. I have my own concerns, but I think the statute as written by the legislature says that any individual or firm have to have a firm registration based on the definition. So I'm good with
that. That was the administrative code that was mentioned?
Arizona revised statutes define that any individual or firm.
Yeah, what number was that? What title?
32101.
32101?
Yeah, okay. Under number 13, their definition. So definition number 13 is for firms, and it means individual or partnership that offers to the public professional services. So that's what I think, when you read the firm registration requirement and you understand the definition going back to it, then it makes sense to me. We also have published numerous newsletters that requirement for firm registration. Ignorance, I don't think, is an excuse. And I'll leave it there. I do think that I'm not sure we need firm registration, but that's what the statute is.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. Kurt, a roll call vote on this?
Dr. Alejandro Angel?
Aye.
Jack Gilmore?
Aye.
Neil Jones?
Aye.
Clarence McAllister?
Aye.
Carmen Wyckoff?
Aye.
Stephen Newell?
Aye.
Andrew Everode?
Aye.
Helmuth Hack?
Nay.
Stacy Skanky?
Aye.
Motion carried with one nay.
Okay, thank you. So we do not have a call in on 5D1. Do we need a break or do we want to keep going? Turn the heater on. I'm not sure we can do
it. Hey, Neil, we can hear you, man.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. There appears to be some discussion being picked up by a microphone that's obscuring part of what you're trying to say and maybe confusing other participants.
Thank you, Mr. Donald. I think we were begging for the heat to come on, but that is outside of our state statute as well. So, okay.
Madam Chairman, did you want to...
Yes, actually, why don't we do that? Why don't we skip ahead to 61, sir? I see
6D.
D is in David. 6D1. We have somebody here in the audience, and I appreciate you coming in. So we will go to 6D1.
We also have a universal applicant here as well.
Okay. So, Mr. Zecco?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Come on forward. State your name for our folks on the phone.
My name is Brian Tucker.
Appreciate it. So, board members, a little bit of background. Our state rules say before you apply, you can come before us and see if a criminal background history is going to make your application favorable or not. Nothing we say here is going to bind future board members, but we can give Mr. Zecco. Okay, we can give him our opinion at the moment. Okay, so this is 61, and I'll let I'm sorry, I keep saying Zecco, Tecco.
Tecco.
I apologize. Mr. Tecco, this is a felony conviction from 2020.
Correct.
I'd love to turn it over to you for a few moments. I've read through and am very sympathetic, but our Attorney General has also weighed in a tiny bit on our statute as well. So if you can just kind of state your case in a few minutes for the board.
Sure. My name is Brian Tecco. Honorably discharged from the military. I was a 92 Romeo parachute rigger back in 2000.
Thank you for your service.
Father of four. I'm a third generation locksmith. I've been serving the Tucson and surrounding communities for 20 years. Cancer survivor, had cancer, and during that it kind of put me down for a while. And part of that coming up is I got involved with the marijuana program in the state. What I've come to learn with that is when there's laws in the books that say that you can do something and laws that say that you can't, assume that you can't. So that, you know, caused me to receive a couple of felonies. Moving forward, I'd like to become a home inspector for the state of Arizona to continue. For the last few years, I've been working in construction out of town, and it's been hard on my family, and I'm looking for something that's within my scope of expertise to transfer it into a different career to move forward towards my retirement and still be able to serve my community.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thanks. And so for board members, I'm not going to comment on the marijuana laws. We've got kind of a quagmire here. The previous to this, I was kind of taking a look at our statutes 32-122-02 for home inspectors. The only thing I would bring up for board members to look at is number 7, have received an absolute discharge from a sentence at least 5 years before application. And so, you know, myself personally, reading the letter that you wrote, I was incredibly sympathetic and thought, you know, our whole state has evolved and we're constantly evolving, but I wonder if this one statute ties our hands at all. And that's my opening on discussion from board members.
It's been 5 years?
No. I have 2.5 years of probation. I'm almost 1 year in from the actual conviction date.
Technically, it's 4 more.
Technically, I have 4 more years. I didn't know about the statute. Yes.
Our executive director face matches mine. Sorry, on the phone?
Yes, Madam Chair, I was going to ask Mr. Donald, our AG, if he could explain the statute and what that means, where it says that, you know, discharge in the last 5 years. Hold on, let me look at this. Have received an absolute discharge from sentence at least 5 years before the application. Because I think we know, unfortunately, Mr. Tecco was convicted of a felony. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what does that mean specifically? Unless one of our, I don't know if Sandy ever wrote us on the line or Ms. Kanky can shed light on it as well.
Certainly, Dr. Angel, I'd be happy to. This essentially, there are two aspects of this. The first is the question of whether the felonies themselves would bar the applicant from becoming licensed by the board. The second is the strictly procedural question of the application of 32-122.027, which, as a board chair provided, requires that an applicant for a home inspector license have received an absolute discharge from sentence at least 5 years before the application. So effectively, the board can provide the applicant with guidance on whether the felonies will, or whether his criminal record will disqualify him from application or from licensure by the board. That question is not going to impact the timing of it because there is a statutory requirement of a 5-year period before absolute discharge. The other factor that comes into play, however, because of this 5-year period, is simply one of timing and the legislature and the nature of the statutory scheme in Arizona, which is that by the time the applicant applies, if it's 5 years, well, depending upon when his absolute discharge is, if it was 2020, then should he apply in 2025, obviously any determination on licensure would be made by the board at that time using the statutes in place at that time. It is always possible that a future legislature might modify requirements one way or another, so the board can't give an absolute guarantee that the gentleman will become licensed at a certain date. What the board can do solely is determine whether or not his criminal history will present a bar to a future board. And that determination is about the only type of advisory opinion the board is able to make. Because again, at the time of application, the statutory scheme could be different. We have no idea what statutes would be in place at that time.
So am I understanding you, Mr. Donald, that I mean, there's a statute that requires 5 years after discharge from sentence. We're not dealing with that, although Mr. Tucker should be aware of that current statute, may or may not change. The only thing we're doing today is deciding whether his felony conviction would disqualify him from registration forever, you know, without a timing component.
More or less, Dr. Angel, yes. The board will be determining whether or not his criminal history would disqualify him from licensure. And that could be a very easy answer. Unfortunately, because of 32.122.02, he may have to wait several years before he'd be able to apply, but the board can provide him now with information that could impact his decision to pursue a course of study and ultimately submit an application.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. Any other board member questions?
I am sympathetic. I'd like to see this guy get approved, but our hands are tied.
Yes. So at this moment, however, if we wanted to make a motion, we could say that we don't believe his criminal history, means that he does. We believe, despite his criminal history, he is of good moral character and repute, and that we encourage him in 4 years to apply with that board or to watch our statutes in the meantime to see if they change. Maybe.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think in principle, I wouldn't say anything about that we encourage him in 4 years, because I think, as Mr. Donald said, we don't know what statute's going to be in place. What I read is we basically need to say, does his criminal history disqualify him from licensure? And that included two things. One, does he have a felony, which he does? But if he does, then does the, you know, interest in protecting the public is superior to his personal rights? And that's where we need to decide. I'm with you that I don't think this specific case, I think his personal rights are not compromising public safety, so I guess I'm good with what you're saying, that we need to make a determination. I mean, that's what the statute says, make a determination whether he would be disqualified.
So, Dr. Angel, I'm going to make a motion. This is a little complicated one, so I'll throw a motion forward that the board has determined at this time his criminal history would not necessarily preclude you from getting a home inspector license. However, please watch the statute, see if they change, and of course future boards might have a different opinion. Is that a motion?
Is this something that actually needs a motion at this time? This is just the review.
I would say, Madam Executive Director, that it may be prudent for the board to have a motion, considering this is a there is a requirement that the agency make this determination if someone requests it concerning their criminal history, but it may be able to be made with a much narrower motion, perhaps simply the motion that the board has determined that the gentleman's criminal history will not disqualify him from obtaining licensure. That motion might address the specific need of the...
Would it be prudent to include exactly what you said, a determination, were it not for the timeline that's spelled out in statute?
Okay. So my motion is that I move that the board has determined that his criminal history would not preclude him from getting a license if it were not for 32-122-027 that he needs to wait 5 years. That is my motion.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Yes.
This is Steve Noel. I've got a question regarding this. Could he make an application next year? I mean, are you going to seriously follow the Senate and the legislature and what they're doing? Well, it'd be easier to make an application than somebody to fish.
I would recommend that you are welcome to your staff at any time for any legislative changes to this, law in particular. We're happy to do that, but I would encourage an application because there's fees involved, which is why he's submitting this review ahead of time. After every legislative session, you can give me a call. We'll update you on anything.
Yeah.
Sure.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I may, Scott Donald, the Assistant Attorney General, if I may make one suggestion just for clarity's sake, it might assist the board to perhaps end the motion after the phrase getting licensed, simply because the if not for 32-122.02, that wouldn't actually, that may not impact things in the future. We don't know if that's going to be in place, and we couldn't necessarily say that he would, that that's impacting.
100% agree. So I will amend my motion to end after the word licensed. Mr. Jones? Thank you. Kurt, a roll call, please.
Dr. Alejandro Angel?
Aye.
Jack Gilmore?
Aye.
Bill Jones?
Aye.
Clarence McAllister?
Aye.
Carmen Wyckoff?
Aye.
Stephen Noel?
Aye.
Andrew Everett?
Aye.
Alec Hack?
Aye.
Stacey Skanky?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you for coming in. And
thank you.
Appreciate it.
Good luck.
We have one more person in person, so I'm going to suggest we take them before a break. That is 7B3B. Mr. Van Oost? 3B. So, for board members 7B3B, that's a universal licensure as a home inspector. I believe this is all pretty straightforward, isn't it, Kurt? Or Julie? Awesome. So thank you for coming in and sitting through the last 90 minutes. I very much appreciate it. I bet you learned a little bit.
I did.
You don't have to go back here again, right?
Learned enough to keep your nose out of trouble, right? Board members, yes? Yes.
So if you would like to, since you're on this topic here.
Oh, could we consent something?
Yes, you can for B3, A, B, and C.
Okay. So 7B, 3, A, B, and C.
Yeah.
And those are all universal licensures, and we would welcome a consent motion for those three items.
So moved, Chair.
Thank you.
Second.
And I got a second. Thank you, Mr. Jones. Any discussion? Okay. Okay. This can be all in favor, say aye, for 7B3.
Aye.
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 Any opposed, say nay. Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Van Oost. Welcome.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to suggest you want 5 or 10 minutes, everybody? Okay. 10 minutes? We'll be back at 10:40.
Okay.
That's good.
We lose somebody at 11, but we will be back at 10:40, and we are good. Okay. Thank you, everybody.
I'm going to put the phone on mute for that time period.
10 minutes.
We are now recording and back in open session.
Okay, board members. I'm sorry. I should not have eaten a cracker. We'll get our act together. Okay, so we are now up to 5D1. Gentlemen. 5D1, which is, in summary, an interesting case because we've run into this before where aerial drones are being used, in this case for an agricultural overview. And then it got brought before us to ask, hey, is this surveying? Which we know our surveying statutes and rules, we've asked to have them updated, correct? But we are not in rulemaking. Also correct. Okay. So we kind of have surveying rules from a ways back, and these drones, and every 6 months we get another case before us about them. Is that a good summary? Okay. So. If I can turn it over to you to kind of summarize thoughts. This is before us with no recommendation. This is one of these up to us as a board items. Thank you, Mr. Carco.
Thank you. So this complaint came in as an anonymous complaint, so we do not have a name in the ledger. The complaint was based on an online advertisement, which had mentioned using drones for imaging of crop fields. I had looked up the website. The website that goes into what they do does mention using a drone to take imagery of crops. It never mentions making border lines for a map, nor does it ever mention surveying. However, it does mention GPS coordinates, and it attests to the accuracy of those coordinates. The express purpose on the website is to give farmers understanding of where their crops are needing water or not needing water, the health of the crops, of that nature. We had made several attempts to reach out to the respondent, who's a non-registrant in this case. We've been unable to reach him at any point, despite several phone calls and emails, and doing some online searches for new contact information. We were, however, able to contact his business partner, Mr. Baker. It has been confirmed that he is also a principal of the same company. He declined to provide any documentation or sample reports or of anything of that nature, but he did answer staff questions as to what they're offering. His explanation is that they offer imagery with the drone, using GPS coordinates and whatnot, to the client, specifically for the client to use as they wish. He clarified that they do not make any recommendations whatsoever or make any diagnostic outcomes. They simply provide the imagery to the client for the client to do with as they wish. He specifically mentioned that they are not attesting to the accuracy or trying to make any surveying points. We did send this out to two EAC members for assessment. Both of them came back stating that they do not believe they're offering land surveying practices. Neither of them suggested an EAC committee meeting being adjourned, being made. One of the assessors, however, did mention a concern that some of the language in the advertisement attests to accuracy on par with land surveying. So his concern was not that they're, he mentioned that he does not believe that their intention is to offer land surveying, but is concerned about some of the language used in the advertisement that attests to accuracy. His suggestion or his recommendation would be a letter of concern. However, being that this is a non-registrant case, we don't actually have that option. So we're simply asking for a direction on where to go with it from this point.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Board members, yes?
A question, Steve Noel, a question regarding the accuracy. How accurate would it be compared to Google Earth?
That is a great question.
Is it like that accuracy, or is it...
If you don't mind me going back to the assessor's actual quoted information, on their website, it pretty just clearly says that the drone has GPS capabilities that are very accurate. From what I saw on the website, that's the extent of it. But I'd like to refer to the assessor's statement to give you a more clear explanation as to his concerns. I apologize for holding us up.
No worries. That assessment starts on 1545 of our board packet.
Dr. Angel has a hand up as well.
And Dr. Angel, in the meantime, would you like to pipe up?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you, Alejandro Angel. I look at this case, and if we think this is land surveying practice, then anything, you know, somebody taking measurements at home is, you know, or grading their fields for farming is surveying. I think we have to be realistic that just mapping in itself is not land surveying. And when you go to their website, the purpose of their drone is not to provide boundary lines or design drainage or anything else. They simply say the data can be used for in-season agronomic decision-making and long-term economic forecasting. I don't see how we would take any action on something like this. If we took action here, then every GIS product would have to be done by a surveyor, I think, too.
Yeah. Appreciate that, Dr. Angel.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dr. Angel. This is a business for farmers to help them manage their crops.
Yep.
It's not a surveying type of business.
I think we're going to have at some point down the road, we'll probably have a more challenging case in front of us where someone is doing drone surveying, but I don't think at this point it's not this one.
We had a discussion at the L&R committee last week, so I can summarize when we get to that point if there's interest.
There's always interest, yeah.
Yeah, Dr. Angel?
Will there be interest at 2 o'clock after we've had a 5-hour meeting?
No.
Exactly. No, I think the issue has come up with people using drone photos to identify property boundaries and overlay them on assessor's maps. And I think what we have done at the board in the past, and it was a different board than what we have now, is that those products need to disclose that they're not property surveys and they're not surveying, you know, they're not intended to accurately map the boundary. They're approximate.
Yeah.
People don't get confused, but I don't think we can regulate people doing that. Simply make sure they don't mislead the public is where we've been.
Agreed. Thank you for the synopsis. So do we have a motion on this one, board members?
Yeah, I would move to close the case.
Thank you.
Dismiss.
Mr. Heck, a motion to dismiss the case?
Yeah, either close or dismiss.
Perfect. We'll go with dismiss. Do we have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Any discussion? On 5D1. If not, Kurt, a roll call on this one.
Dr. Alejandro Angel.
Aye.
Jack Gilmore.
Aye.
Neil Jones.
Aye.
Clarence McAllister. He may have left the meeting.
Okay.
Carmen Wyckoff.
Aye.
Stephen Noel.
Aye.
Andrew Everode.
Aye.
Helmut Pack.
Aye.
Stacy Skinke.
Aye.
Motion carried.
Thank you. So thank you. 5D2, we have perhaps a call in that's, I believe, the Ledger, Ms. Wallace.
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. And we have the investigator is coming forward. Thank you very much. So, board members, this is kind of also requiring board guidance as a quick summary. You know, the customer service perhaps was lacking in this case, but it's also before us because we issued a letter of concern in 2016 for a similar item. And I think that is where perhaps the plot thickens.
Madam Chair, was on April 28th of last year, the letter of concern for this particular issue.
Oh, okay. Okay, got it. So,
issued a letter of concern, it says that they weren't registered as a firm, is that, or were they registered at firm registration?
I think
at the time.
Jones, you're referring to two different cases.
Okay.
One was a prior case, prior to the one where a letter of concern was issued that did result in a consent agreement for a firm. And the second case, now this is the third case.
So 5D2, because they do kind of blend after a while. In essence, 5D2 is the alleger's needed plans a permit in order to get recovery funds in a complicated case with the per contractor, and it took a while, to say the least. And do we know yet if she has that permit? We do not.
No, I don't have the permit. I received an email yesterday from the contractor, the first time he's replied to me in over 6 months, stating that I had to pay him first before he would get me the permit, pay him in full,
okay. And
then call the city and pay that. And I don't trust him anymore, so I already got scammed by the general contractor to the tune of $48,000. And he knew that the room that he was to get the plans for had already been built by a contractor that abandoned the project in the middle of it and took all our money. So he knew that we had been, and then the ROC recommended that I get a self-certified architect because he could, and Mr. O'Connor claims on his website and on Facebook advertising that he can obtain a permit for us in 5 to 10 business days.
Okay.
He came in January last year to measure the room. It's a patio enclosure that we had built for my son who's disabled. And he came in January, and then he contacted me and sent me some plans that he had drawn up and said, you know, pay half, and he sent me a contract, and I sent him the money on February 4th. I took it directly to his bank and deposited the money in his bank on February 4th, expecting, like he told me, that 5 to 10 business days because he's self-certified and at the city, self-certified architect. He said one of very few self-certified architects, and so that's why we hired him, is because we needed to quickly get a permit so we could get the recovery funds from the ROC to get our room completed. And we still don't have the permit today. He's saying it's going to take a couple more weeks if I go in and pay it today, pay the city fees. And I can't log in because it's his account, not mine, so I can't log in to pay it. So he replied to me to call them on the phone and pay it. And then he said before he would release the permit to me in a couple weeks that I had to pay him in full, the entire contract amount. And because I already did that with my general contractor and he hasn't replied to me since June, and I've constantly asked him for an ETA. He just took forever. He didn't even submit our plans until March. initially submit our plans until March for review, and then the city contacted him in May and sent them back, and they had to be revised, and then he didn't even do that until just recently after I filed the complaint. And I had numerous phone calls, numerous voice messages until his voicemail box was full. I had numerous text messages warning him that if he didn't either return our money or get us our permit within, you know, a certain amount of time, that I was going to file a lawsuit because he considered abandoned since I haven't heard from him since June 14th. And even the time when we heard from him on June 14th, it was because we called from my son's caregiver's phone. So he didn't know it was us calling. So he's just been avoiding me completely since June. And he told me then that he had submitted the revised plans. And then we called the city and they said, no, we haven't heard from him since May. Mm-hmm. And so it's just been one lie after another, and I can't trust him. And so, you know, they say that the thing he sent me says that the plans are ready, but that they have to be paid for. And he's telling me, go in and pay him and then pay me and then you'll get your permit. And I don't want to give him, you know, pay him in full because he could disappear on me again.
Sure. I can understand your concern there. And board member, I'm
willing to get those plans, the permit that we need so we can get the recovery funds and get our room finished for my son. I would leave a check, you know, write a check to him and give it to the board, and when he provides me with those plans that we hired him to get us, then I would, you know, stamped and him totally out of the picture, he can get his money in full, what we owe him, the 50% of the contract.
I completely feel for you. As a board, unfortunately, it's difficult for us to weigh into kind of civil contract matters. Board members, I am looking at page 1585. The respondent's letter did mention that he was not doing self-certifying on this because it was work completed without a permit. So that was initially my first question, right? If you're self-certifying, it should streamline everything, but it turns out...
It does. Self-certification. This is Neil Jones. I'm an architect. Self-certification does allow for a much quicker permit review process. So his statement of 5 to 6 days or whatever that's an accurate statement.
For a typical thing. Unfortunately, this was a work done without a permit that he was back permitting.
So that's what my question was. So this patio enclosure was built by a general contractor without a permit.
Right. And we didn't find out about the permit until after we filed a complaint because his work was so shoddy. And he had abandoned the project, and it was really shoddy work. And so he had to go through all the administrative hearing process and filed against a bond. And then we found out he had 22 other complaints. And the recovery fund had to be prorated because they only give away $200,000, and he'd scammed people out of over
$500,000. Wow.
So, and he didn't get permits for any of his work. When he was required to do so by the ROC, and then he didn't show up for any of the hearings, and so they revoked his license.
So
ROC told me to go to the city's the City of Phoenix website and choose a self-certified architect.
Yeah.
So I chose him because of his website, claiming that it would be 5 to 10 business days, and that was in January.
And unfortunately, if we take his response letter at face value, when the work includes work completed without a permit, it doesn't qualify for self-certify. Self-certify is for...
He didn't tell me that.
Right.
He knew that's why I hired him. That's why I called him, is because we were in a hurry to get that permit so we could get the room finished.
Yeah.
Well, this project is a very small project. It's not rocket science. It shouldn't have taken him, you know, 3 days to complete this job. I'm ashamed that it's gone this long the way it has. We do have conduct in our statutes, and he's had 3 prior violations, and I think there's something we need to do here.
the letter of concern from April.
Yeah, it's been 8 months since he submitted he submitted it.
So Ms. Wallace, I really appreciate the background because that gives us a great deal of empathy from where the place you're coming from. What's in front of the board is whether the timelines and the responsiveness or lack thereof constitutes not professional conduct that we want to see in the state. And Kurt?
Dr. Angel
has raised his hand. Dr. Angel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my understanding is the alleger still wants to proceed with the work and sounds to me like what she'd like to get out of this is for the respondent to complete the work. It also sounds to me like the respondent, and we'll get to the delays and the communication issues later, but it sounds like the respondent is willing to complete the work as well.
Well, after I pay him.
He's been a hostage, Alejandro.
Yeah.
Given this background of this case, now he's holding her hostage. I don't like that.
I understand, Neil, but I mean we're not here. Do we have a written contract that says when everything gets paid? I mean, we're not here to settle contract disputes. I think
it says 50% upon plan submittal, and then it says 50% upon permit receipt. When I receive
the permit,
is he
asking for payment of the other 50%, or is he asking for payment of the?
I already paid him the 50%.
Right, but he's asking
for
payment. What
is February 4th.
Now, is it the review fees?
Yeah, he wants his fees. He wants his entire fees before he'll give me the permit.
You need to get the permit first, and then you pay him.
That's the
way this works.
But he replied to me and said,
like
no, you're not going to get him until you pay me.
So how are you going to pay online with the city of Phoenix? That's what I understood from the beginning, that you were going to pay the city.
Yes, I was going to pay the permit fees to the
city. How much are those?
Directly. He didn't tell me. The bill that he sent me, the invoice he sent me was $381 plus the other half, 50% of his fee. But he didn't tell me how much more the city fees were going to be, nor provide me a receipt showing he's already paid $381 towards the permit.
Yeah, and so here's my thinking. I think that part of it is a contract dispute, that it's not our purview. I don't think it is. That'd be like a small claims court issue.
That's why claims to avoid is going to court again.
give me a second, please. I do think that the architect has not been responsive, and we already sent him a letter of concern for lack of responsiveness.
Is he on the call?
The letter of concern sent previously, though, that was a different...
That was, the letter of concern was for different cases before us. This is a new case.
It was for a different case, but wasn't it for the same reason, for lack of communication?
Similar reason, yes, different case.
Right. So my point was, we've already warned this registrant that he needs to be responsive to clients and pursue his work diligently, meet the standard of care, and he isn't. So I could see where we offer a consent agreement to the registrant, and with a letter of reprimand, and then if he's got 30 days to accept it or to move forward with this permit. If at some point the alleger and the respondent both agree that they want to dismiss the issue, then we dismiss it. But at this point, I would be comfortable with a letter of reprimand, given that, okay.
No penalties?
Yeah, well, that is a disciplinary action.
That needs to be discussed.
Okay.
And Dr. Angel, if I may interrupt just for a moment, I just want to ensure that the board is able to enunciate the statute or rule that would actually be being violated by the registrant. That would be a necessary part of any motion, not only the action that constitutes a violation, but the statutory provision and how the action constitutes a violation.
I understand that, Mr. Donald. I'm looking in the rules, but I would think whatever we send the last letter of concern is appropriate. I mean, it certainly goes to good moral character and repute to, you know, work with your clients and be responsive, I think, if nothing else.
I'd like to have Doug weigh in for a moment.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you like to, do you have a microphone over there? Or are you going to need to wander up?
Project. When Greg and I were discussing this case, one of the possible violations that we considered that may apply in this case, and this is why we're bringing it forward for your guidance, would be a possible violation of the administrative code under rules of professional conduct, specifically our 430-301-2 on the list.
Our 430-301-2.
Would you like me to read that?
Yes.
Sure. Thank you, Judy.
A registrant shall not engage in fraud, deceit, misrepresentation, or concealment of material facts in advertising, soliciting, or providing professional services to members of the public.
So one of the ideas before the board is that we issue a letter of reprimand and a consent agreement that gives the respondent 30 days to realize that this is pretty serious and perhaps encourage him to work with Ms. Wallace. Is that our goal in this? Okay. And that would be a letter of reprimand and probably cost of, we always do cost of investigation. No, or kind of looking at staff on this one.
It seems like somewhere in the administrative codes that we can collect money for the ledger. I thought I remember saying that.
There has been, I thought once or twice we've done something along the lines of restitution. Is that accurate?
We
have. Okay. I remember a home inspector where we did that.
Typically that's where the fraud is.
Yes, the board has statutory authority to secure restitution. The issue there generally has to do with evidence of money expended by the complainant. But yes, the board does have the ability to grant restitution. Typically, that is more part of a civil suit. Should there be a collateral suit as well? But
And Mr. Donald, I think the other thing is that I understand the alleger wants to continue with the process. Restitution, we're returning her money since she doesn't get any plans. I actually see that in the packet that the respondent offered in August 30th to refund the monies, but that would start the clock again on things, you know, with the permit application and everything else. So, I mean, if that's what the alleger wants, I think that can be solved.
The alleger wants a permit, and I think we all want to avoid a lawsuit. I'm sure.
Yes, yep. I want a permit and avoid a lawsuit.
Thank you, Ms. Wallace.
That's all I wanted in the first place, because we don't want to start over again.
Can it be included in the consent order that he hands over the permits immediately and...
Well, the problem is, I think if we send a consent order saying that he has to obtain a permit in 30 days or whatever, that's outside of his control because it depends on city reviewers.
Well, it sounds like they're ready to be. It sounds like they're ready to be picked up. He's just holding off to get more money.
So
that's what he said to me.
If the permit is approved,
he can download them as soon as I get in and pay the city.
Well, can you check with the city to see if a permit is being issued? And if so, then you pay and you have your permit.
Yeah, why do you need to?
They won't give it to me. They only will release it to him because it's in his name, his account.
Right.
But you can't ask the city if they're ready to issue a permit?
He forwarded me the city's notice that they're ready to issue the permit.
So the permit's sitting there. Ms. Wallace, after delays, doesn't trust that the architect will turn it over.
Right.
The architect is not downloading it without the other half of his money, and we all want to avoid the lawsuit.
Happy to give him all the money I owe him after I get the permit, but I just don't trust to give it to him, and they'll disappear another 6 months on me.
Well, how's this? she go ahead and pay the money, pay him his 50 extra, the last 50%. And if he doesn't follow through, then we go after him for all the money.
For restitution. That's actually...
And restitution and all that. We go after him. We put this on hold for the time being and have her go ahead and pay the money to get the permit. And if he fails, then we will go after him for restitution.
Well, I was going to pay the money to get the permit. My issue was he wants me to pay him before he'll release the permit to me.
Well, I would suggest pay him the money and, you know, the money that's needed for the permit. And if he fails to perform, then we
that's
will.
That's not what he's asking for, though.
Wait.
Hold on, hold on. Hey, one at a time. Okay. Let's wait for me to call on you, please.
I'm worried that we're getting into giving advice, and that's not our business. We could get in trouble for that.
Mr. Donald, I'm calling on you. How about you weigh in?
Well, Dr. Angel is quite correct. The board is beginning to deviate a bit from the board's traditional role in this type of a situation. And the board certainly can pend the case to see what happens. The board may not want to advise the complainant in how to handle the situation because the board has no means of determining what's going to happen in it, and the board can't be held liable for any results of any actions that the complainant might take, whether or not taken on the board's recommendation. So recommending courses of action to the complainant is not really where the board legally would want to go. But certainly the board may pen the case for a month to see what happens in the case should the complainant take further action, should the respondent fail to turn over any of the necessary paperwork. Ultimately, at the end of the day, there are aspects of this that might be more appropriate for a civil suit depending upon what happens in the future. So it may be premature for the board to act at present.
Thank you, Mr. Donald. So, board members, I call your attention to 1592 of your board packet. That's the agreement with Ms. Wallace. It says city plan check approval. That's when she owes him the other 50%. So, Ms. Wallace, if your goal is to pay out your architect completely, get your permit, and make this all go away, I think the board, in response, would love to pen this until next meeting, have our investigator perhaps give the meeting minutes or our opinions here. And certainly, if your architect were to take the other 50% and not hand you your permit, that would be completely, in my opinion, violation of good moral character and would be back before the board. Does that help reassure you in your situation?
Within the two-week time period that you said that it would take for them to issue my permit?
At this point, it sounds
once
like
I pay?
The city of Phoenix has already seen it. Yeah?
Madam Chair, if I may answer that, all that the board would be able to do would be, at this point, would be to say that it would be placed on the next board agenda for consideration. The board wouldn't be able to guarantee any action based upon a certain time frame. At this point, the board would only be able to retroactively look at what occurred.
I appreciate that. So,
Madam Chair, is it fair that, I mean, I think we...
Yes, Dr. Angel?
Madam Chair, I was just going to suggest that we simply put the case, or ask staff to put this case on next month's agenda so we can continue to monitor the status of it.
And have our investigator let the architect know that that case will be before us and that we're very interested in the outcome of this permit?
Yes, and that, yeah, exactly. Okay. That.
So, Ms. Wallace, having heard the board and all of our informal opinions, we feel for you, and we hope that by next board meeting we've got a great resolution and that you're on your way.
Okay, so I should go ahead and pay him then to get my permit?
We can't tell you to do that, but certainly if you have further trouble, we're very interested to hear from you next month.
So if I pay him in full and he doesn't send it, then next month you'll discipline him. Okay.
If I may, Scott Donald, Assistant Attorney General, I think that all the board can say is that if you pay the gentleman and he doesn't provide that, the board will be considering that at their next board meeting. The board can't guarantee any particular outcome or any.
I understand.
Sure.
Thank you, Ms. Wallace. I appreciate you
clarified to give him the rest of the money that
Scott, do we need a motion to continue this then until next month?
Scott, do we need a motion, or is this just direction to staff?
Oh, no, direction to staff is fine. This can simply pen to next month.
Thank you, Mr. Rome, and thank you, Ms. Wallace. We all are keeping you in our thoughts.
Okay, thank you.
Interesting cases. Okay. Excellent. Are we, Julie? Are you up? You are up. We got out of the fives. Congratulations, everybody.
Julie.
Quite a few items this month.
We do.
I would like to couple some of the items together because they are for similar consideration. That's acceptable. And in our best effort to help everybody get through them quicker.
Yes,
thank
yes.
you. All right, so 6A, 1, and 10 are similar in that the applicant's PE exam do not have a specified designation. NCs does not know it, the state they took it, they do not specify it on their NCES record, so that's why it's before the board. In reference to Rule 30-201A1, says that the applicants have to take the PE exam in the branch in which they would like registration, so because we don't know what they took the PE exam in, that's why on the agenda.
Julie, we're one of four or a handful of states that has a discipline-specific right. fundamentals
yes.
exam.
This is for the professional exam. Actually,
PE. Okay.
Discipline-specific engineers.
So in many states, you just are an engineer. And so when people apply, our struggle is some of the states just don't track.
They don't track. They don't necessarily care because they are just issuing professional engineer licenses versus specific civil licenses.
Yep.
But structural, mechanical, electrical, and they're saying that other states don't do that.
You're an architect or you're an engineer.
Correct.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. We're in the minority.
So we
really?
have agenda is to talk about in greater depth.
Yes, we have a whole agenda item. So in the meantime, though, we have two applicants under
number 1 and 10.
6A, 1 and 10.
Mm-hmm. For number 10, Mr. Ruiz, he did provide an email statement saying that he did take it in a specific designation, which was electrical. His degree is in electrical. He has 13 years of engineering experience. Mr. Zitch, he also emailed, but he said his exam was a combined test, which was considered just a professional engineer exam. He said in most states he's just considered a professional engineer.
500 months of experience, the 681.
And they're both applying for civil. Oh, no, one is civil. Number one is civil engineer and one is electrical engineer.
But we would need more than just an email, wouldn't we?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Noel is asking a question, and I think we approved he passed. We just don't
just
know
says,
in what discipline.
Right. It just says PE unknown or not specified on their council record.
So they definitely passed the test.
Mm-hmm.
In
1977.
Madam Chair?
So. Yes, Dr. Angel.
Hey, so this might be a moot point. For two reasons. One historic, which is, and I think at least in one of these cases, the person had passed the structural one exam the first 8 hours. A lot of states, and I think including Arizona 20 to 30 years ago, used that to substitute for the regular PE exam. So So when we go back to our statutes, we called for having, you know, similar registration requirements. I think it works. It matches what we do. And then the other thing is 32.126, in terms of our statutes, also says that, let me see, I'm looking specifically, 32.126B1. And it basically says that someone who has a registered engineering license in one branch can get registered in another branch if they have 4 years of experience acceptable to the board. So, I mean, someone like this who has 500 months of experience, or the other electrical engineer, they've demonstrated plenty of civil experience, plenty of electrical experience that's acceptable to the board. So even if their exam wasn't something else, under our statute, they wouldn't need to take the exam, the civil exam. They would just be exempted by this statute that shows that they have 4 years of experience in the other branch.
That's an interesting point, Dr. Angel. If it's not by exam waiver, it could be by something else.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Okay. Any other board discussion on 6A, 1, and 10? Julie, do you think we should walk through all the 6As and then consent them, or do you think there's anything we need to... Do we need to vote as we go?
All the 6As? Just these?
Do you want to approve them all?
Three, five, and eight. Sorry, all the other ones I think are great.
Let's just take 6A, 1 and 10 to start with. This is with the PE, the test not in a specific discipline. Do I have a motion on 6A, 1 and 10?
Madam Chair, I move we grant registration in civil and electrical engineering, respectively.
Thank you, Dr. Angel. Second? Second from Mr. Noel. Any discussion? Okay. Can we do an aye on this?
Yes.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed say nay. Okay, 6A, 1 and 10 are done. Let's do whack-a-mole. What's next?
I would ask that we skip down to 6C, 1 and 3. Dr. Angel was referencing that Structural 1 exam. So both of these applicants did have taken the Structural 1 in the past in other states. And just why they're listed under the waiver.
So 6C, as in CAT 1 and 3, are kind of a similar case. In this case, right, they've taken the Structural 1 exam. I would also point out that they both have more than 10 years of experience registered. Kurt?
And 6C1, Jeffrey Mahel, wishes to be called.
Okay. And does he wish to be called if we vote yes?
I don't know.
So okay. I sent out a notification to all the
thank you for doing that.
I think they don't necessarily know if they have to call in or just, you know, are calling in case there are questions.
And 6C1 is also seeking to be a civil engineer.
Yes.
Just one and three.
One and three want to be civil engineers. They have a council record, 10 years plus experience. Which there are different routes to get registered. That would also be a route, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes. That's why I had listed them under the waivers because they had been licensed for at least 10 years.
And both passed the structural one, the first part of the structural.
Board members, do we have any questions for Mr. Mel, or we just want Kurt to give him the good news?
I have a generic question.
Yeah.
This guy's a structural engineer, basically, and he wants to be a civil. I mean, they're engineering, but they're two different disciplines.
Well, it didn't say they passed part two of the structural engineer. So if what Dr. Angel's saying is that it's somewhat common practice to accept the structural part one, because it's that two-part
in
exam.
In support of civil.
Yeah. Right. He has a master's in civil and an undergrad in civil. And 31 years of engineering experience, but he is a generic engineer because that's what other states do.
But
that's
not necessarily what we do.
But we do give them a license if they've been registered for over 10 years in another state or over 4 years in ancillary engineering discipline.
Well, I just think of all the problems we have with civils doing structural work. Now we're going to have a structural engineer doing civil work.
I don't believe
maybe
he
not so much his case, but just in general, this is...
Well, in Utah, he's structural. In Nevada, he's civil. And everywhere else, he's a generic engineer.
Generic engineer.
Yes. A GE.
That'd be the term.
Well, these guys passed a structural exam, but they're not structural engineers. To be a structural engineer, they need to pass an additional exam. So they, right. Yeah, they pass a structural one, which a lot of states substituted for the PE, civil PE,
yeah,
3 years.
I've done a PE exam just based on experience.
Because if they had passed the structural two, that would have been on their council record currently.
Okay. So technically, he's due for an exam waiver on civil because ours say you have to have an exam in the discipline you're applying for. However, Julie and I, talking about it earlier, said, well, he could also come in through the 10 years of experience. So if we don't want to do the exam waiver, I don't think there's any reason to kick out an application and have a reapply with the 10 years of experience.
Dr.
You know
Angel
what I mean?
Noted that taking that structural exam back in the day was similar to the civil, so.
Yeah.
That's good.
Okay. That's kind of it. Okay. Do we have a motion on 61 and 3?
Chair, I move that we waive the exams for 61 and 3.
Thank you, Mr. Noel.
I'll second that, Chair.
Ah, Mr. Gilmore's in for a second. Kurt, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed say nay. 61 and 3 pass. Okay.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, do we still have 8 total? Is Mr. Everode still?
Mr. Everode, are you there?
I'm still here.
Okay, just checking because I wasn't sure I heard 3.
So. Okay, cool.
Thank you.
Thank you. Julie, what's up next?
That's up to you guys. If you want to breeze through the A's,
let's go back to A.
Yep.
You're thinking
I think
2, 4, 6, 7, and 9.
Yeah. Well,
second.
Okay.
I think what Dr. Angel said is
2, 3, 4. So 2, 3, 4, and 9 are discipline issues that were prior and resolved.
Yes.
6, 7.
Those are 2, 3, 4, and 9.
Yes.
Have very similar issues before us. Does a board member want to talk about 6A, 2, 3, 4, or 9?
I don't have any problem with 6A3.
I'd like to talk about 3.
Okay.
Not necessarily the other one.
Go time.
Yes, 6A3. Well, how do you want to discuss this?
Well, Madam Chair, yeah, so I think in general, and by the way, if it is possible, I'd like to maybe put an item on a future agenda to discuss how to weigh this criminal history so we don't have as many cases to go through. There's cases where people, I don't know, stole something 25 years ago and were deciding whether to license. To me, that's not necessarily relevant. So, but that might be for a future agenda item. You know, whether we can grant authority to... What's that?
How do we streamline that, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Do we want to give authority to the director or staff to deal with those? And give some direction on what's important.
Dr. Angel, you're getting a lot of smiles in this room.
Yeah, good.
Okay. So 6A3.
Okay, so the 6A3 is the only one that worries me a little bit because he lied on an application saying that he had done his continuing education. Then when he was audited, instead of admitting the mistake, he actually went and did the coursework hoping that he wouldn't get caught, and he got caught again. So I don't know, it worries me that it might be someone who, if they made a design mistake that affected someone, they would try to hide it instead of own up to it. That's my concern.
Well, he paid his $500 administrative fine, and his license in California is in good standing. Maybe he learned his lesson.
Do we know that? I'd like to hear from him at some point. I mean, I'm not going to die on this hill, but it just... People like that who lie and instead of admitting, just continue to lie. Not necessarily a great professional to protect people. I'd like to have at least a good statement from him as to why he did it or appear in front of the board would generally be my interest. But.
Is he available to press reach out to? He did not respond about
calling in a response.
Well,
But I think if the pleasure of the board is to approve it, it's not the end of the world.
So our choices are, I mean, obviously we can deny. We could also approve, or we could pull it and ask for a written letter about this, I guess, are the choices in front of us, right?
He did provide all documentation to Julie that was asked for.
He was being cooperative?
Yes. So he didn't try to hide his prior disciplinary action.
So he checked yes on his application and all that, like he's not covering this
and
up.
Provided the explanation.
I don't know. Dragging him in front of us to rub his nose in it, kind of.
And the fact he's in good standing with California, so you would hope they have looked into it.
Yeah, I'm inclined to approve it. I would actually make a motion to approve 6A, 2, 3, 4, and 9. Is that what we're on?
Yes.
I second.
Thank you, Mr. Heck. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. Thank you. Thanks for bringing that up, Dr. Angel. We'll hopefully never see that gentleman again. Okay, 6A.
Can we skip to 6A8? Mr. Alexander was brought before the board last month, and the board directed to offer him a civil license, and so he has accepted that.
Fantastic. So 6A8, just as a reminder, we sort of went through his application. We thought he was a civil would be a slam dunk versus a structural and kind of a stretch.
He also took the civil. Structural one exam, so that was kind of the same situation. So,
do I hear a motion on 6A8?
I move to accept for civil.
Thank you, Mr. Heck.
6A8,
do I hear a second?
I'll second that.
Second by Mr. Noel. Noel? Sorry, I have a client that's a Noel, so it's driving me nuts. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed, say nay. Done. Okay, 6A5, 6, 7 are all ones where one of their certificates of experience was not a registered professional.
At least one.
And so it comes before the board to take a peek at their resumes and determine if that is sufficient guidance or oversight. Is that about right, Julie?
Yes, to vote to accept the certificate of experience.
So, and it needs to be a 2/3 majority. Pretty exciting. Everybody's taking a peek. Yeah, 6A5, 6, 7 are all similar.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would move that we approve 6 and 7 because they had at least two registrants as the reference, and the third ones were either, you know, past registrants or had resumes that, you know, show that they would understand the work being done.
Okay. And does that mean 5 gives you a pause?
Yeah, I want to discuss 5. I'm not in support of 5.
So we have a motion on approving 6A, 6 and 7. Do I have a second?
Second.
Second from Mr. Jones. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Okay, 6 and 7 pass. So 6A, 5, a little more interesting. Here. So, Dr. Angel, all yours.
Okay, so my concern with this is twofold. One is that none of the references are professional engineers. And in fact, one of them is an attorney. And no offense to attorneys, but, you know,
I get it.
One attorney and two non-engineers are vouching for it. And then when we look at the award description, what the applicant was doing, it just said, I managed several, this is on every certificate of experience, is the only thing we know about her experiences. I managed several parts of the construction project and managed crew members. I prepared daily reports for my supervisor, which included an estimate of time and material cost. That's not engineering, in my mind. So one is the references are not appropriate, and two, the work is not engineering. I would be willing to grant 12 months of credit, which is the maximum that we can give for construction supervision instead of engineering. So with those 38 months and of education credit that she received and the 12 months of credit construction supervision, she might be able to get
her
FE exam to take the FE, but I'm not. Yeah, they're not engineering references.
Note that it is just to sit for the FE exam. It's not for registration. So she does just need to demonstrate 48 months total.
So 48 months total to sit for the exam, and if she got 12 months of credit for construction oversight plus her education, would that qualify her?
Yes.
Okay.
But didn't Dr. Angel say that the construction oversight wasn't necessarily engineering?
So can you say that, that we would grant them and that we would consider the references appropriate to get the 12 months of credit for construction oversight, but not for future licensing as an engineer potentially? And therefore, with 12 plus 36, you can take the exam.
I get you there.
Oh, so the timing is to have experience to take the exam.
Yep. To sit for the exam, and then after that, she would also need to demonstrate more experience with an engineer as her supervisor to be able to get licensed. Cool. Thank you, Dr. Angel. That was a good clarification. I think that helps me. With that, I'll make a motion that we approve 6A5 to sit for the exam, and perhaps give her a reminder that further experience needs to be under a registered engineer.
And, Madam Chair, can we clarify that, she's approved to sit for the exam, but we're limiting the experience to 12 months?
Yes.
Because it's construction experience?
I appreciate that clarification. We're limiting the experience to 12 months because of the kind of experience. Thank you.
Thank you.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. Okay. 6B, 1 through 4, is a simple extension, which we've been granting a little bit more often because the last 18 months have been nice. Do I hear a motion from the board on 6Bs?
Chair, I move that we extend a request for the applications for their exams, PEs, civil, FG, geology, okay. For all four, B1 through 4.
Excellent. We have a motion for an extension. Do I hear a second?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. That one passes. 6C2. Last one in the 6Cs, I think. Board members, if you remember, this gentleman is working in Egypt. We tried to get a hold of him last time, and time difference and the technology were not our friend.
I see him on the list. He's been here since the beginning of the meeting, so I'm not really sure if he's...
Actually, you might want to hear from Julie first as an update to the additional information.
So, Julie, I think we asked for a bunch of items like why Arizona. And for board members, I'd like to point out that his application was actually reviewed by 8 structural engineers, and their opinions varied. So,
but the items that requested, yes, by the board in July, we did get those items provided to us, and it is in your packet for review. But yep, as like Ms. Whitehouse said, the structural engineer's opinions varied on whether, one, if it was structural work, or if he should be granted structural registration in Arizona. So, generally,
just as a reminder, Dr. Metwally is applying for exam waivers for registration, and his certificates would need to be voted on for acceptance.
Because they are not, are they registered in his, in Egypt, or not at all?
Hard to tell.
Okay.
We were able to get a date on when he was registered in Egypt, which we didn't have last time. Correct.
'90s, is that accurate?
92.
Yeah. I apologize. I'm not seeing why he's applying in Arizona. I may have, I totally missed
a brief statement in an email response.
Okay.
He said something along the lines of that it can help them design stuff in the Emirates, which sometimes require fees, and then he might also move to Arizona someday.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Angel. I was struggling through the emails a little bit.
What, with the 3,100-page agenda?
Yeah, yeah. I read the other 3,000. Okay. So, Dr. Angel, I apologize to kind of call on you, but this civil versus structural, it's always kind of a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah, I didn't want to sort of prejudice the board in case anybody had thoughts. I have my thoughts on this one.
I personally would like to hear it because I think you understand that split a little better than I do.
Okay. So I think, to be clear, I was the person who originally did this review when it came up. And my concern was the fact that even if he knew structural principles, he might not understand codes and how they apply here in the U.S. I think Julie is right that the opinions from the structural engineers vary. Some thought he would be qualified. Others thought that the work submitted was primarily computer printouts and echoed the same concerns about code. So the opinions were all over the board. So what I was trying to think through is, you know, this is a person, and with all due respect to Dr. Metwally, we don't know him, we don't know his references, and he hasn't taken any of the exams to demonstrate proficiency, and we're being asked to grant him a license.
Yeah.
I'm uncomfortable doing that. If we wouldn't do that for people who've gone to school here, for instance, in Arizona, we wouldn't let them get licensed just with their degree. So he's got a degree from somewhere else. He's got references we don't know, and he hasn't taken our test. He did take a test in Egypt that was 100 multiple choice questions that I don't think is necessarily comp, and it was open book also, so it's not comparable to what we do here.
No, so,
based on that, I'm not comfortable, and I'm not comfortable granting a waiver of the exam. I think if Mr. Metwally was willing to take the exams and pass them, that would be different. But granting licensure without examination, I'm not comfortable.
I would agree.
Thank you, Dr. Angel. I was looking at Mr. Gervasio's review, and there are waivers for other states or U.S. territory, but this is definitely pushing the envelope. So, board members, any other discussion? This is we would definitely welcome him sitting one of the exams. I think his experience lines him up to sit for an exam.
You take the first? He hasn't taken any U.S.
No, he has not taken any U.S. exams.
Yeah, first for sure.
Yeah. So at this point, I'd make a motion to deny the exam waiver application on 6C2.
I agree. Second.
Thank you, Mr. Hack.
An authorized exam.
Based on his experience, can we authorize him to sit for the exam at the same time?
He hasn't applied
to sit for the exam, I think he would need to do that first.
I think in the past, if someone has applied for a waiver and the board has not granted it, they would then give them the permission to sit for the exam instead.
I think one less piece of paperwork would be great.
Amend the motion?
Yes, I'll amend the motion that we deny his exam waiver, but grant him the opportunity to sit for an exam if he so desires. Mr. Hack, would you second that?
Yeah, I would second it.
Thank you.
Does he still have to make the application for the exam?
No, at this point we would be granting him the ability to sit for the exam.
So we're waiving cost of the exam?
No, we're waiving the $100 for him to reapply for the exam versus his current application.
And just for clarity, I think the initial exam would be the FE exam.
That's exactly what Mr. Winter just said. Good point. So I will amend my amendment that he can sit for the FE exam. Thank you, Mr.
I second.
All those in favor of...
Madam Chair, if I may interrupt just for a moment, Scott Donald, Assistant Attorney General. So this gentleman did specifically apply to be able to sit for the FE in the event that the board denied the exam waiver. Is that correct?
No, he did not. In the past, in order to streamline paperwork, we have in the past said we're denying the exam waiver, but instead approving him to sit for the fundamental exam should he choose to.
Okay. And so this is in accordance with prior board practice?
Yep. In order to streamline our amount of paperwork, which we all enjoy.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thanks for the clarification. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed say nay. Okay. 6C2 is done. D1 is done. Consent agenda. These are awesome. So we've got new names for the EAC, correct? That's exciting. I appreciate, for the record, wow, do we appreciate these people. So thank you for volunteering, any EAC members that are listening in. We also have 6B. One.
Madam Chair, do we need to act in 7A1? We usually...
Do you want to do consents? Oh, licensing is separate. Thank you, Dr. Angel, for grabbing that. 7A1. I move that we approve consent agenda 7A1. Do I hear a second?
I have a question on 7A1.
Yes, please.
Three of the individuals do not live here in the state. Seems like that might pose a problem with either sitting for an assessor or a reviewer. And it seems like somewhere along here there's a requirement that they be local in the I thought I had it. I don't have it. But anyways, it seems like they need to be local. It's like judged by your peers. So if someone a respondent is from Maricopa County, the assessor and reviewers need to also be. I can't remember where that was at.
We definitely haven't done it by county in the past, but
no.
It's a state registration.
In the 301, I know that, but
I have a question as well, Mr. Hack, I'm not as concerned about them being in the same county because we can do stuff remotely. And next time I promise I'll come in person. but I do have a question as far as have we verified and that they don't have any discipline against them. We do have some standards for EAC, and I don't recall seeing in the packet, and one of them I think was discipline, and the other one not having discipline. The other thing we've generally looked at is having a minimum amount of experience.
Yeah, I don't think we quite have. Well, some of them are well qualified. But again, it's kind of like if they're out of the state and they've been out of the state for quite a few years, they may not exactly know what the requirements are to the different cities and counties and stuff. And it seems like, you know, they could clearly handle the math questions, but anything that pertained to a city in that, they would not be qualified because the cities are different.
But we, in theory, should only be regulating four standards of which they're registrants and should know. We're not, if they don't know Flagstaff standards, that's not what we're disciplining anybody for here.
So well, if someone's being... who has a second home in Oro Valley, so he must spend significant time here. Otherwise, why would he? Why would you volunteer with us? good question. Yeah.
So,
sorry.
So to answer some of these questions, I'm not aware of anything that would limit an EAC to just the state of Arizona. Their languages are registered or they're registered.
Okay.
I can read.
The EAC requirement is that when practicable, each committee shall be comprised of one public member and a minimum of four registrants, at least one of whom is registered in the same category or branch as the respondent. The committee members shall provide technical assistance to board staff in the evaluation and investigation of complaints. The only requirement that I'm aware of is that at least one in the EAC needs to be a registrant in the same category or branch. There certainly may be a preference for local because you may be holding to a standard of practice in a certain area depending upon what the issue is, but I'm not aware of a legal requirement that EAC members be from a certain area.
Okay. The area that I'm looking at is Article 3, Regulatory Provisions, R430-301, Rules of Professional Conduct, and it's Item 6. A registrant shall apply the technical knowledge and skill that would be applied by other qualified registrants who practice the same profession in the same area and at the same time.
Certainly.
And if they're out of state, they would not be able to do that. Because they wouldn't be familiar with the possible area. I mean, we'd have to be cautious as to where we allow them to function as an assessor. You know, if it was just a strictly survey engineering or whatever math problem, they could handle that. But if it had to pertain to a local issue, they would not be able to.
How many of our EACs are virtual?
If I may just to quickly address that from a legal standpoint, that's the requirement on the registrant. That's their professional responsibility requirement. They're being held to the standard of practice of a qualified registrant who would practice the same profession in the same area and at the same time. That's not a requirement of the investigators or the EAC members or the board members who will be evaluating this information. Ultimately, it's the board who will be making determinations on potential violations, and that's the standard that they'll be held to, but that doesn't have any requirement regarding the people who would be investigating or pursuing potential violations.
Well, I understand that. It just seems like, you know, there is a letter about whether they might have do they know the respondent or, you know, is there a bias? Mm-hmm. It seems like there needs to be a question that they're familiar with the area that they're performing just to kind of show that, you know, they will be on the same page. Because I know for the survey standpoint that things are different in, you know, like the southern part of Arizona than it is Maricopa County. And it's because the cities and counties do things differently. I mean, this is something that I remember going back 20 years ago.
Certainly, Mr. Hack. The issue, however, would be more of one for an expert at the hearing where the respondent would argue that he did actually perform to the local professional standard and that local professional standard was different from the standard that was applied by perhaps a professional from Pinal County instead of Maricopa County. So it's more of an evidentiary issue for a hearing, ultimately, than any question about whether somebody would be qualified to evaluate for the board to determine if there's a potential violation.
Well, there was a case, I think it was about 3-4 months ago, that it was similar. Mm-hmm. We do, you know, things are done differently here in the, especially the Phoenix area. And that's where the case was. And so I'm just kind of curious, you know, it seems like we need to be at least aware of it, so that we, you know, maybe ask a few extra questions and that. I mean, if it's something specific about a locality, we just need to be, you know, the person would have to just say, well, I can't respond to it. And that would also be part of the rules and regulations.
So, Mr. Hack, along those lines, we do have a number of committee members. So, obviously an all out-of-state committee would be highly unlikely. But good point. Judy is raising her hand.
So this is Judith. I just have a couple of thoughts on that. Mr. Hack, there are conflict of interest questions that come up. I feel like you touched on that just a little bit at the beginning before it would be assigned to an EAC committee member. Also, the registrants, I'm sure you as a professional, the professionals would agree, can be registered in multiple states. Regardless of where they live, they're held to the standard and expected to understand the laws of this state if they're registered here. And then, and Mr. Parlin's here, and I would ask him to interject if I'm getting this incorrectly, but in previous conversations I've had with him, when a complaint is initially given to an EAC member for any kind of initial assessment, if they're uncomfortable with the material, I mean, beyond if there's a conflict of interest, but if they feel that they do not have adequate knowledge to truly vet that complaint in the beginning, they make the investigator aware of that, and it will move to another EAC evaluator.
Yeah, I noticed that there was at least one person there that had 50 states that they were licensed in, and that kind of bothers me, too, but oh well.
Overachievers.
Yeah, how can you perform in all 50 at the same time, you know? Anyways, it's just a thought.
I appreciate your feedback, and I am sure when putting together EAC committees, since we have so many in-state, we'll make sure there's a variety on each one. Cool.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'd like to request, I mean, not an issue for this time, but I would like to know, for future EAC candidates, do they have any disciplinary history, and what, you know, how many years of experience do they have, or registrants? Just,
Mr.
Parlin, we've typically done that, and I think it ensures we have good EAC members.
So Mr. Parlin would like to weigh in on that. Mr. Parlin?
Yeah.
Yes, hi, Dr. Angel, just to address your question about disciplinary history, they're all checked before they come before you for any disciplinary action.
We have resumes of most of them.
5 years, as well as their experience, we like to see at least 5 years of experience in the discipline that they're in.
Okay.
Yeah. So everybody in front of you today has been cleared disciplinary action-wise and experience-wise. Unless you feel differently, you have the resumes.
No, that's perfect, Mr. Parlin. It'd be helpful if that's on the packet, but I think that's exactly what we need, and I really appreciate that we got volunteers. I mean, that's a hard job, so I'm glad we do. I don't want to dismiss anybody that's qualified.
That's a great suggestion. Maybe on the list of names in the future, we could just have number of years and checkbox no discipline. That might make it easier. Cool.
Good idea.
Thank you. Okay, I believe we have a motion. We do. All those in favor of accepting the EAC resumes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. Excellent. Motion passes. We are on 7B. 1 and 2. So 1 is cancellations. 2 are new registrants. That's very exciting.
I checked for you, Neil. You're okay.
And Neil is safe.
Pass another month.
And then 6B4, is that a simple consent, Julie, or is there anything of interest on 6B4?
The only one is 4D. So all of these have some sort of background sort of review, but 4D also has the COE one is not registered. So vote for that one.
Okay, how about we consent 6B1 and 2?
6.
I move we consent 7B1 and 2. Do I hear a second?
I'll second that.
Thank you, Mr. Noel. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed say nay? Okay. 6B1 and 2 passes. 7B1 and 2 passes. 7B4. So Julie mentioned that an item of interest might be D, as in David?
Yes.
So D as in David has a misdemeanor, but also mentions that
one of his certificates of experience is not registered.
Thank you. It's not a registered professional. So so we are on 7-4-D, 2-8-1-3 of your board packet. So all of these have misdemeanors in their backgrounds. 7-B-4-D, Mr. Tobin, one of his certificates of experience came from a non-registered professional, but the other certificates were registered.
Right.
Okay. So we can have discussion on any of the items under number 4, or we can have a motion.
And I would also say that there are a number of call-ins for this.
Oh, are there really?
But again, I think...
If needed.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Is anybody actually sitting on the phone?
Madam Chair, can I? So we're talking about 7B4, A through G, right?
Oh, wait, A through I.
Yeah.
I'd be in favor to approve.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Heck.
Yeah, I would also I would move to approve all of them. I had a little bit of a concern with 4G, but so I would second Mr. Hack's motion.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Angel. Okay. Any discussion about any of these before we move
on? Madam Chair, I think one quick item for discussion is I generally... If someone has a misdemeanor that's more than 10 years old, I don't think we should even worry about that for registration, unless it's, you know, really related to the profession. But just to streamline the process, I would sort of suggest that we put those on a separate bucket.
Okay.
For future reference.
And staff is glancing around. Just think, everybody, I think, is in agreement just thinking through how we would do that.
I think we already decided to put that on a future agenda to...
Yes.
Okay.
So I believe on our next board meeting that we will be addressing what delegated duties we want to give staff in relation to misdemeanors and felonies.
Perfect.
Excellent. So right now we have a motion and a second for 7B4. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed say nay? Okay. Number 8. We do not have an update for Mills' case. This was just a placeholder just in case. Okay. 8B. 8B is, I think, Judy, was this one that, this was about PEs and FEs and how we don't follow all of our brethren in the country.
Right. We just... Julie, Heather, and I all had a little bit of a discussion with a member of NCWES about this. And this was new for me, and Heather. I don't know. We're all maybe Julie's fairly new still to this, so it's a big learning experience for us. So I had no idea that... that we were so unique in the fact that we recognize these specific branches or disciplines within engineering
in Arizona, so much so to the point that we're only one of four, I think, Steph said, does that sound right? Jurisdictions that do that, which all of this came up because this National Council for Stacy, who's this is where, if you're going to be an engineer, this is where you take the exam. You have a National Council record and you take whatever exam. So there's the fundamentals exam and the professional exam. The fundamentals exam, a lot of our statutory and administrative code language references the specific branch or discipline that you're seeking registration in, and you take the FEE or whatever. Well, so we just found out that they only offer, so we have 17 disciplines, right, that we recognize. Nationally, there's like 24 of engineering. There's only 7 FEE exams offered by NCWS. 6 of them are specific, which just for fun, I'll tell you that one of them is not structural. Of the 6 specific, which is mind-blowing to me, right? Because that's the big exam. So anyway, and then the 7th one is a catch-all, fundamental engineering, every other branch of the exam. So say one of the ones that's not as, I don't want to say popular, not as prevalent, like fire protection or something like that. So you could be taking the same FE exam for your structural or fire protection. I mean, it's like a catch-all that they said is even a little bit more difficult than like taking a specific FE electrical engineering exam because, you know, you have such a variety of everything.
Dr. Angel, would like you to speak up.
Oh, me? I thought I'm so loud. I'm always telling everybody else to be loud. Thank you, Alejandro. Okay,
thank you, Julie.
So, let's see. So, part of the problem, I'm just going all over the place with this whole thing because it's interesting how it all ties together and how I feel like our laws and rules are a little bit prohibitive or restrictive for applicants because NCES, who gives us their council record, who we rely on for knowledge that they've passed whatever exam, they don't even track or indicate which fundamentals exam an individual passes. So Julie gets notification, it just says they passed the FE exam. You don't even know which one. Mm-hmm. So any of our language that says you need to take the FE specific to what discipline you're seeking, we, you know, really almost can't work. And then the other thing too is that apparently we are kind of unique in that we require board approval for somebody to sit to take the fundamentals exam. You guys, tell me if I'm off on this, because isn't that what Steph said, that generally most jurisdictions, the FE, they can just sign up and take it. It's like an automatic okay.
Okay.
So I thought, wow, okay. And then we went round and round with our legal counsel, Scott, because there's some places where it says branch specific and other places in our laws or rules where it just says seeking in the profession. Shall submit proof of examination directly from the authority, which would be NCES, to the applicant seeking professional registration as an engineer, at geologist or land surveyor, that's easy. Those are already, you know, very specific. And shall pass the applicable fundamentals exam before admission to the professional exam. An applicant for registration as a geologist. Okay, that doesn't even apply. But anyway, there's just all these different places here. So maybe what we can do is just continue this conversation. I just kind of wanted to bring it up because it was such a big thing. I felt like that we just stepped into. And we don't want to be restrictive on with our language as, you know, compared to anywhere else. And then, just to add to the fun too, Julie, like you had here on the agenda today, I mean, you get these people coming in from other states. They're an engineer. They're a professional engineer. Then what do we do with it here? So then we have all these people here that we're asking you guys to grapple with and figure out what we do with them.
So you're saying there's an, Alejandro, you can answer this maybe. There's an exam for engineering in the state of Arizona, or that's part one, that covers all the disciplines, structural, mechanical, electrical, civil, maybe, and you can pass that. I can see where that's harder than if it was just specific to a discipline.
Well, NC's offers seven fundamental exams. Six of those are specific, and I'm sorry, I don't have the list in front of me. I know, like, engineering, civil, you know, there's six that are specific fundamental exams to a specific branch. Okay. The seventh exam that they offer is for all the rest.
So Judith, and I...
Yeah, go ahead.
I can chime in, and I hopefully I'm not oversimplifying it, but I think it is simpler than we're thinking. First of all, just to explain what the FE exam is, the Fundamentals of Engineering exam is a six-hour exam right now. The first half of it, everybody answers the same questions. It's stuff that's common to all engineering. It's got math. It's got, physics, things like that. That's for everybody. Then the second half, there's seven different ones for civil, for mechanical, for electrical, for chemical, things like that. So that's how they're different, but they all have the morning in common, or the first half in common. As I read our rules, and this has always been my understanding, we don't grant someone a engineering training certificate civil or engineering and training mechanical. We just grant engineering and training. So I think our branches are not applicable to EITs, and therefore it doesn't matter which one they take. If they take any of the seven, they get their EIT. And that's what I read from R430222 also. When they go, and when we talk about the respective professional examination and the branches, I think that's when we talk about they have to take the right PE exam to get the right designation. And at that point, there's more than seven. I think, NCES might have 15 exams or so. We do have, long-term, we have some rules to clean up because, we have some of the branches we have, nobody gets registered on. There's no exam. There's others that I know, for instance, the highway engineer one doesn't exist anywhere, and it was done to accommodate some ADOT folks decades ago. So there's cleanup to be done, but I guess to simplify things, if somebody takes any FE exam, they're engineers in training, and then the requirement to become a PE is to have an engineering in training, pass the professional exam in the right branch, and have the experience. So I think we just need to worry about which professional exam. In other words, if somebody passes the FE for electrical engineering, they still pass the core engineering stuff in the morning. So then if they want to become civil and they have the right degree, they take the civil PE and get their civil PE.
And I think, Alejandro, that follows what we have generally done, is that we accept pretty much any FE, but then we get really specific on PE. Okay.
Right.
Right. So, talking about registration, R430-201, A15, when it's referring to evidence of successful completion, let's see, about halfway through, an applicant seeking professional registration as an engineer, geologist, or land surveyor shall pass the applicable fundamentals examination before admission to the professional exam. So I guess in that one it doesn't say specific to the branch or whatever. So applicable fundamentals could just mean any FE.
Yeah, there's fundamentals of land surveying. There's a similar exam for geology. So I think you're talking about all the different professions. So it's talking about that the FE for that or the fundamentals for that profession, Judith.
And the in training of and then. Back to the in-training designation in R430-202A1, it says evidence of successful completion or waiver by the board of the current fundamentals examination in the category and branch, if applicable, for which in-training designation is sought.
So well, we don't have an in-training branch designation, right?
Branch for in-training. So we're
current fundamentals exam in the category.
The board is saying that because we don't have electrical engineer in training as a designation,
so even though
therefore
it says
the fundamentals doesn't count.
If applicable, is not applicable.
It's not applicable because our EITs, you're an architect or an engineer or whatever in the training. Geologist. I would like to point out our geologists are not feeling the love.
We love the geologist.
She brought you treats.
Who's weeding?
Okay. Well, I think that helps clarify.
It does. Thank you very much, Dr. Angel. I am going to continue to dig on this because it's still... I want to find out more statistics nationally about what's going on.
And the statute, so the statute allows us just to do waivers, and if the board down the road felt we could create a substantive policy on where waivers are going to happen because we've always historically done them versus, like, there may be a spot where we could give staff a little more direction so that we have a lot less unknowns every board meeting. Is that a good goal?
Yep.
Yep.
That'd be my goal.
Something like that.
Something like
that. Am I missing any important thing, Julie, that we talked about? I don't think I am. But I just keep going back and forth between these statutes and rules, and I'm struggling with it to make sure I feel confident and solid on it. So, which I hope that's what you would want me to do.
Yes. Well, you should feel comfortable with the fact that the engineering exam, the fundamentals, you get 3 hours of the basic exam that they all take, which if they, I don't know, Dr. Angel, do they give you a grade for each exam, like the first half and the second half?
Yep, they do.
So if you pass the first half, that's the basic engineering, and then that second half is...
Yeah, my general reading of things is that the branch, as I see it in our statutes, applies to the professional designation, not the EIT, because they're not discussed anywhere on the EIT.
Yeah. And all of this discussion is helpful because part of this, too, is because NCEES is not real happy with us because people have to come to the board before they can take the FE exam. So,
Hey, Judith, and have you checked with Melissa? That doesn't sound right. I think... We had automatically approved people who got an ABET degree to get registered for the exam. If you don't have an ABET degree, you need to show experience or comparable education to substantiate 48 months. But we automatically get 48 months of credit for having an ABET degree, and that's all you need to get to take the exam. So I thought we had... done automatic authorization for ABET degree holders.
I appreciate that history, Dr. Angel.
Because I thought this was something Steph brought up.
They are auto approved if they do have an ABET degree. Or
with NCs.
Yes, through NCs.
Okay. So, yeah. Dr. Angel, you're right.
I thought they were
Julie's saying
anybody that wanted to.
Yes, according to NCs, they are approving anyone that attends an ABET school, so they don't have to provide any verification. They're at any point,
like
they could be a sophomore, freshman, they just have to say that they're attending an ABET school to take the fundamentals exam.
But usually what happens is they say they're attending an ABET school, they pass the test, and then if they want to get their engineering training certificate, then they apply to the board to get the certificate. It doesn't delay the taking of the exam, I guess, right?
The fundamental exam is just proof of background, but you have to be able to take the professional exam and pass it. That's
right.
That's really the bottom line. This is just getting there.
And I want to help these people get there as quickly and easily as possible. So.
Yeah. Okay.
Why these old guys don't want to, when they want become a professional engineer here, let's say, they don't have to go back and take that exam because they know they've forgotten all that stuff. So they just want to be a professional part. Mm-hmm. That's where the 10-year thing comes in, or 12 years, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Right, because I know we are not restrictive in how you can ultimately obtain registration here in Arizona. So, okay, thank you for the discussion.
So 8C is brought before us by our very own Mr. Gilmore.
Yes.
Which this one was quite a shocker because I don't think I have ever turned over CAD drawings that have my stamp on them.
No.
Because then anybody can do anything they feel like and they don't even have to try to plagiarize me.
And that's what caused all the uproar within our design team. And some of the members are ready to arm up and dive up there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think collectively we all agree. First of all, we called staff and said, why on earth do you need our CAD files with a stamp? Well, GIS staff says we have to have it. And that was the only response. So I said, our design team collectively agreed that we would give CAD reluctantly, but we're taking off the seals and we're putting off the construction. But we questioned them on a first submittal for site plan approval, why do you need CAD?
Because you're going to change anyway.
Because we're going to change anyway. We said that exact phrase. Well, that's what GIS calls for. Our concern was they wouldn't accept the application for review until you satisfy, because that's what the city told them. They do that completeness check.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been in for since last Wednesday. It's not been kicked out yet. It's not been 5 days either. So I was just curious if anybody else on the board had experienced this. We have learned subsequently that there's been such an uproar at the city's surprise that this requiring the stamp's gone away.
I bet so.
I bet so.
I mean, you might as well just turn your rubber stamp into them when
yeah.
you walk there. I mean, like, what the heck?
So,
to be clear, it's the stamp CAD drawings giving them the files.
Right. They wanted your
with
CAD.
The stamp
they
in the file.
Press all
yeah,
the
but
layers.
It's a CAD file that they could mess with. If you give them a PDF, like we always
at
do.
At least they have to use the snipping tool.
That's what we do.
Yeah, and everybody's fine with that.
Yeah, exactly.
But giving an electronic version of all that is what not acceptable.
Yeah, that's not acceptable.
So.
Well, and I think if they want to require CAD files and make it a city requirement, that might be their prerogative. I don't understand why we would have to give CAD files with a seal on them, and that's where I think it's a board issue because every registrant is responsible for the security of your seal. And how can you ensure that if you're having to transmit it to everybody?
Yeah.
So.
Good point. Kurt's raising his hand.
Mr. Heck would like to speak.
Oh, Mr. Heck is virtually raising his hand. Mr. Heck? Maybe. You're muted, I think.
He is muted.
Oh. We can't hear you, Mr. Heck. Can you unmute?
You're on your phone, *6 on your computer, the microphone icon.
In the meantime, I share your outrage.
Yeah, well, I think moving forward, the scene's backed off. I think there's been a lot of calls complaining about this. So, you know, this may blow over very quickly, but I was just curious. I thought this should be up for a quick discussion. Because by the time we made the submittal and got this feedback, since then is when I learned they backed off on this. So,
it's probably blown over by now. Got so much.
Yeah, I mean, if we experience this again, I'll bring it back.
Yeah,
but
bring it back.
The whole issue again is, I think the building safety and engineering would like a plat, for instance, for subdivisions, for police and fire protection. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be a CAD drawing.
Right.
Or it could be a CAD, but it didn't have to have a stamp on it.
Right. I mean, we turn our CAD over to the owner all the time, but
yeah.
we remove our seals before we do.
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
I'm with you there. Director's report? Oh. You're up.
Buried in the pile, yeah. Okay, so we're well into our fiscal year here. Received our appropriated funds. I think I went over that last month. And so far, our expenditures are at 23.6%. We always have some bigger bills right at the beginning of the fiscal year. Some people that want their
annual payments like rent, things like that, all up at the beginning of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And as usual, you've got the cash flow summary report for your review. We turned in the annual budget package and five-year strategic plan as due, actually a week early. I'll tell you what, Heather was amazing on the budget, just absolutely off the charts, wonderful to work with on the budget this year. And I don't think we really ran into any problems or difficulties. We just had two justifications, with the online transition being one of them, and technology budget requests for appropriated funds for ordering technology. So the online transition is still it's still in progress. Lots of fun with that. I don't want to belabor the topic, but ADOA, that's Department of Administration and Asset Strategic Enterprise Technology, is very much interested in the fact that so many boards are looking into this particular online vendor that we also like very much.
Okay.
Loeb, the one that the state wanted people
that's
to use.
That's kind of exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting. It's really exciting. And so they're looking into that now and recognizing that it's it would be a benefit. So we'll just keep monitoring that and working with everybody on that. I mean, also economically, the vendor that we like the best was actually the most bang for the buck too. Quite a lot less than the original, should I say, state-approved vendor that wanted over $1 million to set up a system for us.
Wow.
So this was like a fourth of that. Yeah, it's interesting.
Cool.
So we'll keep rolling with that. The digitization, also very, very exciting. Part of the reason we're not in the other room, besides the fact that we just won't fit anymore anyway in our boardroom, but now if you want to walk in there after the meeting, it's lined with file cabinets, which we had to move because we reconfigured some cubicle space to make some more room. And so a week ago, we're down to two vendors that each picked up sample boxes of all of our documents, microfiche, whatnot, that needs to be scanned and digitized. And we're still struggling with those bids. I don't want to say struggling, but trying to make sure that we have everything fully vetted and looked at, that we know it's all going to be covered, because we do have appropriated funds to move forward with that project. Board composition. So since this turned in here, I can already give you an update. So yay, we have Stacy Skanky with us here. We're so excited to have a new public member. And then also yesterday, I was able to speak with, for the first time, Mr. Aaron Green, who also returned his oath of office. Aaron is also an attorney, and just very pleasant conversation on the phone yesterday. But because he had no notice, I said, we're okay with a quorum if you prefer not to. You're welcome to participate today. He opted not to, so he will join us next.
The best news of all of these are additions for quorum, right? They're not replacements? They're additions?
Yes, so because technically Stacy's replacing Mr. Montgomery. I don't know what seat. Well, he was a public.
He was a mechanical engineer and left us about 6 months ago. 12 months ago? I don't know. Time flies.
And Aaron is in a vacant, actual vacant spot. So, yeah.
But that's great. That's great for quorum.
Pleaded with boards and commissions, please don't replace a body until the vacancies are filled, because quorum is difficult. So, it's really.
So you're still here, Andrew.
Mm-hmm. I know. I was hoping for a different report.
Not yet.
I think Mr. Green sounds like a great replacement.
You can't negotiate this.
Do you have any questions on any of the other licensing or enforcement numbers that are all included in your packet? I'm really happy to provide those. The NCWS heat map that I put in there, just, I guess, kind of for fun, I just wanted to show you
for the structural engineering exam, because there was a lot of talk about that. So that's just informative, meant to be informative for you, because that's the last exam that hasn't gone to computer-based yet, because it's so difficult and so long. So they're still working on that, and that is their end goal. But there's a lot of talk about that. And when we get to our associations part on the agenda, Dr. Angel might want to add to that conversation. But really, that's it, unless you have any questions or anything you want me to answer.
No? It's fantastic. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I don't have anything to report, but I would like to encourage us all, if we're, especially when we're within Maricopa County, to come here in person. We're having a bunch of pretty challenging cases, I think, before us, and I would personally appreciate being able to see people's faces. I think it would be easier. But I understand if you're on travel or outside of the county. I get it. So that's all I got. Am I?
Just come in person.
Are we doing open meeting law today, or are we bumping that, or what?
I would be more than happy to, if the board wants to. That's entirely up to the board chair's discretion, but I'd be more than happy to present a training.
So,
if we wait till next month when a new person comes on, so we have two new folks to listen.
Right, we can certainly do that.
Sure.
And I will reach out to boards and commissions after our meeting today as well and find out where we are on potential new members continuing to come in, and Scott and I have talked about even maybe scheduling a meeting to go over open meeting law outside of our regular meeting that could be all virtual or something, so that we wouldn't take
yeah
away
by the time we get to it. I just don't have brain power anymore, Scott. I'm
yeah
sorry.
Certainly, that's perfectly okay.
Thank
so
you
maybe
for being flexible, Scott.
Maybe a half an hour virtual sometime. That might be really helpful.
Yeah.
Certainly. Absolutely.
Standing committee reports. We see that's in our packets. Anything of highlights there?
Does Andy have anything to say about the home inspector?
I don't, other than a couple of the guys on our committee have a subcommittee, and they're working on a few things, and it's going to be a few months. How vague in general is that?
I love it.
I think they decided they would probably meet a little bit more frequently than they had in the past.
That'd be helpful. Board members' meetings. What do we have of interest there? Let's see. August.
Oh, we skipped the L&R committee.
L&R committee, yes.
Dr. Angel, do you want to talk about the L&R committee meeting?
Yes, I'm happy to talk about L&R. We had a meeting last week, and we had three or four requests for the committee to review items. One of them was the requirement from ADEQ, or the questions ADEQ had about licenses being needed or not needed to do a septic.
Yeah.
And it ended up being resolved along the lines of we don't need any substantive policy. I think it's clear that all single-family residentials are exempt, and that about 90% of the premise that come up. And then if it is not residential, then there's other exemptions in statute depending on cost and other things. So we thought the statutes were clear, if not maybe a little bit outdated. So there's questions about, again, are there statutes that we should revisit at some point? But they're clear as they stand now. There was another question about agencies forcing people to make changes to their plans when they submitted them.
Yeah.
And I think we discussed if any action was needed and didn't think any action was needed. That should all be reflected in the minutes. And then the other issue was about drone mapping and what we should do. So all those things are reflected in the minutes.
Yeah, what'd you guys, can you give me like the 2-minute highlights of the drone mapping since that ends up before us so often?
Yeah, so the site that they complained about, that someone complained about, was removed and it was operating in Canada only. So it really wasn't something that we needed to act on. But again, and this, I'm going back now, right, 4 years, Carmen, or five, we had someone who had a drone and then used it as part of real estate transactions to show boundaries of the property. And it wasn't, they weren't serving the corner properties or the property corners or anything else. So I think we took action on that case years ago because there was no clear disclaimer or understanding of the public that those really weren't the boundaries. You know, walls and other improvements might show up in the wrong property. So my recollection from that is that we are asking that if something is not based on actual surveying of property boundaries, that they need to disclose that to the public prominently.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Yep.
Hey, while you have the floor, any comments you want to make about NC's?
Clarence was there and so was Judith, so we'll see if they want to add. I only remember two things that were sort of controversial. One was, as Judith mentioned, the structural exam, and they did decide that they're only going to hold it at 15 sites for the next couple of years, 2 or 3 years, until it goes, that's going to be the last exam to go, all computer based. Right now there's only that one and the civil PE. The civil PE is being offered in 3 weeks, pencil and paper, and that's the last time. It'll be computer-based come January 1st. So structural is next, but in the next 2 years, they're going to offer it at 15 sites. I assume there'll be a site in Arizona based on the demand. Second issue was on the definition of this is just for model law, so it's not our statutes. It's for what NCES would like model law is what they would like statutes to be across the board to facilitate reciprocity and universal licensing. So with that discussion on what kind of experience surveyors needed to have, because right now the requirement is to have progressive field and office experience, so both field and office, there was discussion about removing the need to do field to get a survey license, but I think that motion ultimately failed, and the definition remains the same, that you need to have progressive field and office experience to become a surveyor.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Can't imagine surveying without ever surveying.
Right. Virtual surveying.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks for the update.
That's it.
Okay. Any other board members' updates on the committee or the councils?
We had... last week we had CLARB here in Phoenix.
Oh, that's right.
That was Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And the best two things that I got out of that, we had a national disability group, Pieces of Me. I'd never heard of them before. And Pieces, P-E-A-C-E, Pieces of Me. And they were disabled folks, and they came to Phoenix just to share their experience, how we might, as landscape architects, maybe improve how we design spaces.
Cool.
So we walked the Arizona Center.
I'm not kidding.
And found all kinds of problems. I was amazed at how difficult it is for these people to get around, because once you approach the Arizona Center, these guys, one of them was blind, but was very good with the stick. And the other lady had severe chronic back problems. Mm-hmm. So the guy that came with the stick had, of course, no idea where he's coming. He doesn't even live here. But as you get into the space, he was looking for Braille notes or Braille map. Nothing on the elevators. Mm. Nothing on the stairwells to give him any kind of direction. Nothing on any signage. no Braille anything anywhere. So then we were talking about the depth and height and depth of the treads on the stairs going down to that little plaza. And they're different. Different depths. So some are like 8 or 9 inches, others are like 12. So they talk about how that is can be challenging.
You know what else that particular gentleman mentioned that I thought was fascinating was what's that crushed gravel? What's that called?
Oh, there? Decomposed granite.
Decomposed granite. So when he was navigating, and he really was very good for, you know, being blind, and when he stepped on that, it totally threw him. He thought he was in a flower bed, but it was actually a walkway. But to him, it felt like a flower bed, you know.
Same thing with synthetic turf. He could not tell the difference. It was kind of interesting. He just got his law degree. So I think he's going to get a lot more active.
Yeah.
So that was really very informative. Really great speaker, this guy. And just shared a lot of insights, stuff that we don't normally even take for granted. Mm-hmm. So that was really an eye-opening experience. And the other thing that came out of the conference, and I've been reporting on this for years, they're shooting for a uniform standard for examination.
Yay.
We've been hearing about this for 6 years. I think all the trades are doing that. But we're supposedly getting closer and hoping to come up with something that CLAR can establish as the minimum standards to sit for an exam. And they're all different. Not all different. But everybody has to take the national exam, but how you get there is a little bit different. So they're trying to come up with a uniform definition. And then you want to come to individual states. And that'll be a challenge because I think we have to get the legislature to approve that.
Well, it'll be
for your planning, your plant material, your hard surfaces, everything to do with landscape architecture isn't the same all over the United States. Right. Certainly not Alaska.
Like your example of the granite.
That'd be very challenging. You're right. That'd be very challenging to do that.
Yeah, I think a lot of states have the uniform national. But then they have a separate section just dealing with local stuff.
Yeah.
Like stuff we have to deal with every day.
That's what I would hope that 90% of it could be.
So, yeah, it's a moving target, and they've been working on this for years, but as far as I can tell, we're no closer.
So, I'm going to elaborate just a tiny bit more because Jack was a rock star, made the board look great. The first, the one day that we had the outdoor experience that you just described, the next day in the afternoon they had a brainstorming session where the landscape architects all discussed these things and the, what was his name, Daniel? The gentleman and the lady from Pieces of Me organization kind of facilitated the conversation along with Jack. And it was just fascinating. And I want you to know that I did my very best to reach out to every legislative representative from the Commerce Committees to attend this event, and also the representatives from District 24, where the Arizona Center is, invited them to be a part of any or all, some, none, anything, please, and sent many emails there. And we thought a couple were going to show up, and we ended up showing up, but we tried. And CLARB's board asked me to do that, which I thought was a great idea to help show some of the scope and depth of what is involved in landscape architecture, knowing there's so much misunderstanding there that, you know, yeah, you're just mowing lawns or something.
Is this something our local landscape architects could attend? Is it just you?
They were invited, Mary Estes from Norris. She's our ASLA chairwoman. And then Erica, what's her last name? She's the assistant. But they're both ASLA. So they participated in that Pieces of Me
project
review. They actually set up most of the slideshows.
Cool.
So they were very, very helpful. Normally we don't bring ASLA into this unless there's some specific issues.
Well, it's like NCARB.
There's a lot of overlap, obviously.
Yeah. Okay.
But they're doing a lot. They would like to... I appreciated that they spoke a lot about the national exam, the LARE, that's keeping it relevant, making sure that it stays in line with industry trends and technology changes and things that are
that are going on, and then they would very much like to, I think, model NCARB and have a council record situation that that has API interfaceability with any online licensing program that the states have, which made me nervous at first. I looked up API. They kept throwing that around like we all knew what it was. Application Programming Interface. So, and I think Kurt knew what it was, sort of, kind of. But anyway, I appreciated them talking about it because as we are trying to move to an online process, which will be wonderful, and every time I mention it in front of any registrants anywhere, they're like so excited to hear about that. If we can incorporate that into our platform, what it allows is, let's say, for an applicant to apply for a council record with CLARB, and say CLARB asks for 10 items, and Arizona maybe asks for 14 on their application. It allows a technology transfer so that they don't have to redo and duplicate the things that are required to be submitted by both entities. Mm-hmm. So it just really helps the applicant, makes it easier, quicker. So it was great. I really enjoyed being able to be a part of that and watching Jack in action there. It was great.
Well, thanks for going,
there you
Jack.
Go, Jack.
Way to represent.
I can say a little bit about ASBOG.
Yes, please.
The annual meetings come up in October, in a couple of weeks. Unfortunately, I can't make it, but we have people from here going. But basically, the annual meeting is kind of twofold. One is where the judges get together and make the exam questions and answers and review previous exams. And the other is just the business end of things and the organization. Of interest with respect to the exam, it started here because Arizona had the first geology exam in the country.
No kidding.
Back in the 40s or whenever it was. And I remember it had been in the 70s, 78, 80. The professors at U of A, I think, were making the exam up. It was kind of mining oriented because that's what they were. There's geologists. And it wasn't defensible. And so the tech board, they had to have a defensible exam. And I think Ron Dalrymple was you at the time. And he actually carried a gun. He used to be a policeman or something.
Oh, my.
It's pretty interesting. But anyway, so he brought in a psychometrician who's still working with ASBOG exams to come up with a defensible exam. And so we had a committee here in the state that came up with the task and knowledge statements that you needed to know and understand to be a geologist in the state of Arizona. Mm-hmm. So we came up with these basic questions and what you need to know. And Jack made these up and he told us, and it was a multiple choice. So we couldn't have a subjective written out answer. So it was multiple choice. And he showed us how a hard multiple choice question versus an easy one, and just go through that whole exercise. So we did that, and then the state had success, and then they took it nationally, basically, and ASBOG was formed, and they used that exam as the basis. Now it's expanded throughout the country. But it was really interesting. It did start here, and I don't know, fortunately, luckily, I was involved initially with that first committee, so I know Jeff from day one. It's just very interesting person, psychometrician. And one of the cool things that I always remember was when he was telling us how you write a question, and you can make it easy or hard. And it had to be, I think it had to be five answers. So one was the answer, two had to be close, one was a throwaway, one was close to being a throwaway. And so you could make a question, for example, when his example to us was, what college football teams won the most games in history? And your choices would be Alabama, ASU, U of A.
Which one's the throwaway?
So, I'm U of A now, but whatever it was. So you could see how it, say, maybe you said Alabama and Michigan, mm-hmm. Notre Dame,
Oklahoma and whoever. That'd be a hard question because a lot of them are pretty close. But you have it set up so you can defend it. You can defend the question and you can defend the answer. And then they would have, after the exam was given, you can sort the exam questions, you get the committee back together, which they'll do at this organization meeting. They'll say, okay, statistically, the people who did the best on this exam got this question wrong. Mm-hmm. Why? So we go back, look at the question. Was it keyed correctly? Was it something in the question that was not quite right? Sometimes we throw the question out. Sometimes say, no, that was the right answer, and they just got it wrong. So it's really interesting just how that whole process is going. So I think you're going, right? Are you going to the ASBAR meeting?
No, and actually that's what I was going to...
Along with our future board meetings.
Mm-hmm. Later, it is on the day of our next board meeting. So we're still trying to figure that out. But yeah, the whole history with geologists is fascinating, and ASBOG and that exam that you're talking about, which was pretty pricey even at the time they did it to hire that.
Psychometrician
to create that exam. And it is fascinating to me that we are still administering the ASBOG exam coming up here. Is that this week, Julie?
Right.
She's got this massive box in there, and there's like 60 people. And we just do it for nothing.
Carmen and I were talking about your test, and we were just kicking it around. We were wondering if question number one is, what is a state rock?
State rock, right.
So
the question would be, is it granite? Is it...
Let's make that up, Steve.
Lava? Is it Leverite? It's Leverite.
I'm not sure.
For real?
We
there
have
is
state
one?
Rock?
Leverite.
Really?
Yeah, they were right there.
Okay.
Our attorney's going to
Jeopardy question.
Topic now. I can feel it.
Is your man there?
See?
You're quite jiggy. Three rocks.
That could be a future topic, state rock.
Okay. So, joking aside, Judy, it's up for the board if we want to have the last Tuesday in October that conflicts with this meeting.
Future board meetings. If we're Scott, since this is on the agenda to talk about future board meetings, is there a possibility rather than the date of the ASBOG meeting, which would be our board meeting on the 26th,
mm-hmm.
if it was
so the second selection
the
day,
second or the third then, Wednesday the third.
I think my other board meeting got moved off of the third.
Can't meet on election day.
I don't know why we can't meet on election day.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Everybody, how does November 2nd look?
Yeah.
This is Andy. That works for me.
Okay, I've got
me too.
October 2nd?
Yeah. No.
November 2nd.
In lieu of October 26th, if the next board meeting was Tuesday, November 2nd.
And I know we don't have any hearings or complaints, notice of hearings have gone on for that date. I do know we have one for the December meeting. So
there is
one is November 2nd, so we are not having an October meeting. We are having November 2nd. And then I hear Mr. Jones wanted to make sure we had a holiday party.
No.
We have a December meeting on the 7th because there's a hearing scheduled for that day.
Okay. So November 23rd is canceled due to Thanksgiving week.
Yes.
Okay. So everybody can take that off their calendar. Delete occurrence. Perfect. So we do not have, and we don't have October 26th because we're moving that to the 2nd. Perfect. Okay, so in December, just because everybody's looking up that far ahead, we have a December 7th meeting. And would that also be a time that we could have a short agenda and lunch? Like our typical
holiday celebration or what?
It's a potluck. Staff makes the food. Whatever you want to do.
So typically we try to either make that a short or
it's an opportunity for the staff. We never get to see the staff. They work so hard for us. They're such wonderful people. It gives us a chance to mingle and get them all.
And typically the board members pay a little more than our fair share to celebrate.
Oh, I forgot about that part.
Remember that part?
Never mind.
Remember that part?
You know, everything I said.
As a thank you to the staff.
So, Scott, since a quorum is present, I've done that before where you agendize or I don't know how you do that, saying that at 1 o'clock or whatever, noon, no board meeting will be conducted, but there will potentially be a quorum present.
Always announce it.
Yeah, I've included past agendas as well, saying the board is going to have a luncheon after this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. And anybody can sit in our luncheon and watch us eat.
Yep.
Okay, but we do have a hearing.
So we have a hearing that we will try to do between 9 and noon so that we can all have a holiday celebration.
Yes. Okay, that sounds great.
As it looks right now, it's probably going to be a meeting.
Pardon?
Never mind. Keep going.
Okay.
Or we'll have a happy hour after holiday.
Hey, Judith, you should have seen this whole road here when you asked about time. Getting the food. So you turn your right.
That was kind of funny. Okay, so on the 7th, we can plan for a hearing and a hopefully holiday celebration.
Thank you.
Okay, sweet. And then the only other future agenda item, we're going to talk about delegating authority a little more on November 2nd. Yes. Okay.
Hey, Carmen?
Yes.
Maybe one other thought. I know I'm being selfish here, but discussing maybe hiring, part-time or outsourcing some of the licensing reviews, application reviews. I know in the past, for instance, we had a lot of volunteers, and it doesn't seem like we have as many anymore.
Julie's
so coming to the board members again.
Julie's nodding along, so let's throw that on our agenda item for November 2nd.
Thank you, Julie.
Great idea.
And I know I owe you like 3 or 4. I'm going to get to them this weekend.
I'm only behind by 2 now, so I'm feeling pretty good about myself. Okay. Anything else before we adjourn? Thank you all. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks for being here. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
That felt good.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Yeah, I crossed that off. Yeah. Occupations I want more.